try to call your members so that we can correct. As you can see, we have got many stakeholders who are going to make submissions today, so we have got a very, very tight schedule. Otherwise, we are not going to make it. Can you please assist?
Okay.
Chair Talin, Honorable Abram, and Mr. Morolong has since joined, so it's six members.
No, okay. Okay, we'll have to start with a very tight schedule. Streamed. Okay. Welcome, honourable members of the of Parliament, members of the Standing Committee of Finance. Welcome, officials from Treasury, PBO, our support team of SCOF, Secretariat. Welcome, officials of Parliament. I saw the communication team here, our stakeholders who are making submissions, both written and oral submissions. We welcome the media and the public in general. The purpose of today's meeting is to get the submissions from the public on the tax laws amendment bill and the draft tax laws, tax administration laws amendment bill and the rates bill. So as I've said right at the beginning that we have got quite a number of stakeholders who are going to make submissions. Let's be strict when it comes to timekeeping. Each stakeholder has got 10 minutes. To make an oral submission. The meeting is officially open. I've already welcomed all of you. Are there apologies, Alan Tebu?
Chair, I haven't received any apologies. Not sure Mr. Hill Lewis declined the meeting invitation, so I'm not sure if Dr. George, if that's an official apology from him, because I haven't received any.
Chairperson, if I may, Honourable Hill Lewis has apologised for the meeting, is unavailable to attend. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Dr. Let's go right away to item two. Item two is the presentations or submissions. The first to submit is the South African Tobacco Transformation Alliance, SAT. You have got 10 minutes. Is SAT in the platform?
Yes, Chair.
Also, you have got a slide to present. Okay. So you strictly have 10 minutes. So who's presenting? Sadrak, CBS.
That's correct, Chair.
Okay. So 18 minutes past 9, you should be done with the presentation. As you can see in the platform, there are many stakeholders today. Over to you, Mr. CBS.
Thank you so much, Chair. Our request, Chair, it's simple and as follows. To request a more sensible approach to use access policy to suppress the growth of illicit market. To request that excise increase be aligned with inflation in order to allow the legal industry to recover and contribute to the economy and save jobs. A sensible excise increase will also ensure that healthy objectives are achieved and by reducing overconsumption of tobacco products due to the prevalence costs of cheap non-taxpaying cigarettes. We support a sensible taxes. Extreme government intervention, such as the 5-month sales ban in 2020, leads to unintended consequences. The ban led to an explosion in the illicit trade in cigarettes. It sets back the progress that SARS had made against illicit trade in 2019. Over 50,000 jobs have been lost across the entire tobacco value chain. Government collected almost 8 billion less in access in 2020-2021. More people than ever before smoke illicit, setting the government's healthy agenda backwards. Enforce existing production counter rules for all manufacturers. Stricter border control and enforcement. Rectify the WHO protocol and implement an independent track and trace system. Implement and enforce a minimum retail sale price of 28 rand for 20 sticks. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks very much, Mr. Nsibisi. You were very straightforward and to the point. Alan,
just to come in, SATA and I think it's the Black Tobacco Farmers Association, they're presenting together, but the BDFA has got a separate presentation. It's also very short. So I can flight that. I think Mr. Jabulani Tembe will be presenting on their behalf. So they together.
Oh, so BTFA will come before BAT?
That's right, Chair. I've scheduled the one slot for ATAP and BTFA because they're together.
Oh, okay. It means each is allocated 10 minutes because they are, as much as they are together, they are separate organizations. Over to you, Mr. Tembe, from Black Tobacco Farmers Association. Now it's 12 minutes past 10, past 9, or 24 minutes past 10, and I hope you will be done with the presentation. Over to you, Mr. Tembe.
Thanks, Chair. Tobacco Farmers Association, we are privileged to be part of this submission. We welcome the Minister's invitation to participate in this, to make this submission. Black Tobacco Farmers Association, BTFA, represent most vulnerable sector of the tobacco industry value chain. And therefore, it is important to voice, it's an important voice in the conversation about the increased excise tax on the sales of cigarettes. Our members have been extremely hard hit by the 5-month ban on cigarette sales that was imposed by government during the first part of national COVID-19 lockdown. On top of that, sales has dropped massively due to the less excise increase of double inflation that was announced by the Minister of Finance. Exactly what we predicted back then actually happened. Legal sales declined. Illicit sales went through the roof, and the total consumption did not decline. Implication on the excise increase. The 8% excise increase proposed in the draft rate bill cannot be justified, particularly as the forecast inflation rate for this period is only 4.9%. The increase increase proposed in the bill will put the excise incidence on the cigarettes on MPPC at 45%, which is 12.5% or 5% points higher than the National Treasury Exercise Policy stipulates. Dozens of farmers have already gone out of business because of the COVID-19 ban on cigarette sales. Sales of the most particular brands of legal cigarettes are down by half right now. Excise revenue is down by half, and at the same time, the illicit market has more than doubled its size. Our request and our proposal, we propose that government must focus on putting in place the effective custom and excise administration and enforcement system to the tobacco industry before it starts looking at the excise policy. We call on SARS to enforce production counters rule by all local manufacturers. We mean all. We also call for stricter border control and law enforcement agencies to make sure that the borders are controlled. We call on the Department of Health to rectify the World Health Organization protocol and the implementation of the independent track and trace system. Finally, we propose that Treasury implements a minimum rate price, MPC, of 28 rands for 26. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Tembe, from the Black Tobacco Farmers Association. You have been invited here to this platform by Parliament, Mr. Tembe. This is not the minister's platform. It's our platform now. You are in Parliament right away. It's just that we are virtual. We were supposed to be in Cape Town. But the minister is in the executive. You are welcome. Thanks for your presentation. And also you try by all means to be within the time allocated. Next presenter would be from British American Tobacco South Africa, BATSA, who's making a presentation?
Myself, Mr. Chair, Johnny Molato.
Collection of around 14.5 billion.
billion for 2020-2021. However, we only saw them collect about 7.5 billion, as my other colleague mentioned earlier on. So the illicit industry was largely driven by availability of cheap products that were selling below what could be regarded as an economically viable retail price. And this subsequently requires, I think, Mr. Chair, a relook at an understanding of the price web of the legal most popular price category, as well as the total market of the most popular price category. What do we mean by this? By this, simply, officially, the official price of the most popular price categories is at 42 rand, which represents, as we speak, around now 48%. And of this, the MPPC currently sits at slightly around 30%. So what this means is that the true real measure of the MPPCC is really at 22.70. So it can't be justifiable if we go into the next financial year to still benchmark the MPPC at 22.70. So that requires a thorough relook at the excise policy and where to actually base excise increases for the next year. So if we look also at as a tool to reduce consumption, we see that over the years it has become more and more blunted, simply because we see the cross-price elasticity between the legal and illicit market. It has been impacted by excise not being able to actually deter people from continuing to consuming cigarettes, rather people are actually switching to cheaper illicit products. So as a result of this, we believe in the legal industry that contributes to the fiscal. We are not able to either compete or deliver the national treasury revenue target because of the significant market share that we have lost over the past few years. So we believe that effective policy enforcement is required to return the market to legality again. What we would propose here is that Treasury and SARS could look at the fiscal year 2019 as well as the last quarter of 2020 as blueprints on how to properly do enforcement, because during this period we saw an opportunity as well as a slight decrease in illicit trade as well as better revenue collections. So if we move into the next slide, where I'll just unpack the detail of what I'm arguing in the previous two slides. So the next slide, please. So if there's anything to take from this slide, what is important, I think, Mr. Chair, is that if we look at the left-hand side of the chart, we can see that from 2019, if we look at the evolution of both the legal and illicit market, you will see that the most, what was selling at the market, the modal price would have been sitting at around 35.70 for the legal market and 19.70 for the illicit market. By the time we entered 2020 in the first quarter before the ban, the price of legal products was sitting at 36 and that of illicit products at around 20. So the gap was still manageable because of the largely of the enforcement activities that are taken by SARS in this period. So we largely commend SARS for the activities that they did in the market to try and stabilize the market. Fast forward a month later in April of 2020, we see the same ban being put in place and a huge spike in terms of the illicit market. The total industry was illicit, which saw prices rise up to almost around 120 rand for a pack of 20 cigarettes. And when we moved outside the ban period, we saw that even though prices did normalize somewhat, the price of illicit products actually decreased further by 9%, which means that the gap between what was legal and illicit was quite significant, which means that excise as a tool to try and reduce consumption was not working as well as it should, because there were more cheap products available in the market than there were before. As a result of that, if you look at the bar graphs on the right-hand side, you see a steady evolution and growth of the illicit market, which from 2020 and what we forecast exit 2021 will still be around 52%, which then makes the point I raised earlier on that the MPPC, which is the most popular price category around which treasury bases its excise rate, is no longer a true reflection of what the market was before. Next slide, please. So what does that mean? What that means is that the true state of the market has completely changed. The same ban and all the enforcement activities that should have been implemented have completely turned the market upside down. We see in the bar graph in the red on the left-hand side that consistently products that were selling below what was then the excise rate, including that of 2160, were being breached. So a lot of the illicit players are taking advantage of this fluid market to sell below what was the minimum collectible tax. So there was no tax compliance. That's what we are arguing about. 41% of cigarette packs were selling below the 2160 price. What we then did was to commission research to actually look at the true market dynamics, which shows you what is actually the modal or what would be regarded as the most economically viable price to sell above the 2160 price. And the research found that actually the 2160 and thereabout is not really economically viable because you only just pay your tax there. And even then just barely by most of the illicit players. So the research found that at least at the moment you could sell at least 21 at 26.55 to break even and 30.95 to be economically viable. I think the reason why we did this research, Mr. Chair, was to just demonstrate that actually the market dynamics have changed so significantly that the size of the legal market has shrunk to the extent that you can no longer reasonably and justifiably still use the 42 rand price point as the most popular category. This requires a complete review of what is the most popular price category. So therefore, if we do not change this or Treasury does not look at this, we'll continue to be tax leakages and lack of payment by the illicit industry. If we move to the next slide. In this slide, what I would just like to show is that in previous years, we have shown to this house as well as to the Treasury officials and BASC officials what is the true state of the deterioration in terms of excise or collections. What we see in those two first green lines, we show from 2019 up to 2022, what was forecast by Treasury and what was actually collected. So you see in 2019, what was 2020, what was forecasted was a revenue collection of 14.2 billion. And what was actually collected was 14 billion, which was quite an improvement, almost on the mark in terms of the forecast and the actual. And that was the year when we saw SARS do fantastic work in terms of enforcement against illicit, which is something that we call for that. If that could continue in this way, you can see a significant improvement in excise collections. However, we know that 2020 was a very different year. And even then, you know, with the sales ban, it didn't help matters. So we saw collections halving, actually, from the forecasted 14.5 billion to 7.5 billion. We estimate, based on our performance to date and what we are paying to date, that even the forecast for this financial year won't be met because of the growing illicit trade that we have shown in the previous slide. But more importantly, Mr. Chair, I think that red bar, what it shows is that let alone just the forecast and the actual collections, there's still a huge gap and an opportunity of money that should be collected that could help the country in these trying times. So you see over the years, there is a big gap in terms of what is actually not being collected at all. So about 10 billion in 2019-2020, 2021, we'll see another 13.7 billion lost to the illicit trade. And we forecast that every this financial year, we're looking at close from 20 billion being lost. and what the sorry.
You have already taken 2 minutes of my time. Can you please round up?
I can quickly jump to the last slide, and just wrap this up in a minute. So, Chair, in this slide, what we simply show you, these are our proposals, and both yourself and Treasury must have this slide, this chart, or the slides that you can refer to. It just basically, we are requesting for a moderate excise increase that is inflation-related, so that we can allow the legal industry to recover, as well as to delay the proposed excise review to allow the market to settle, so that we have at least a proper base upon which we can base new excise increases, as well as increase enforcement to ensure that there is sufficient collection from the illicit players. And finally, Chair, we also propose to balance both the revenue and health agendas by considering the incentivization of the reduced harm program that can ensure that those that want to quit can actually have access to programs that are harm reduced, like the rate of programs. Thank you, Chair, for the time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mloto. Let's move to Limpopo Tobacco Processors. We've got 10 minutes, and now it's past 20 to 10. It should be done. Who's presenting from LTP?
Thank you, Chair. I hope you can hear me.
Yeah, we can hear and can see you.
Okay, thank you, Chair, for this opportunity and the standing committee and my colleagues that have presented from the tobacco industry. Chair, Limpopo Tobacco Processors is the company that processes, the only company that is processing the raw leaves that they procure from legally. So we procure our leaves legally through our subsidiary company that is TPD. So we are supporting local farmers and we buy only 100% local. So throughout the years, a few years, we have been experiencing a decline that has been caused by high input costs and also illicit trading. So illicit trading has been one of the biggest problems that has affected our business to an extent that the farmers, they've been out of business. The farmers, we have lost a few, most of our farmers, and that translates to high unemployment rates and also less money to the fiscals. And most of our farmers, Chair, if I can just also note that, is that most of our farmers are from the deep rural areas. So people that are in rural areas, they have lost their jobs and there is no expectation of them getting future jobs. So if you can just move to the second slide. The challenges of excise increase. Chair, the proposed 8% excise increase is not justifiable under the current struggling economy. We have noted that our economy is struggling. It is for that reason that we are saying that that is not justifiable, Chair. Illicit sales have outnumbered the illicit sales by 51%. That is for the first time in our history, Chair, that we have seen illicit trading being outnumbered in the illicit market. The NKC research have noted that we have seen the illicit cigarette being sold at an amount of 6 rand per pack. So that is just a fraction of the minimum collectible tax. And we believe that the SARS needs to do something. Because if the illicit is outnumbering the illicit market, so there is no way that we are going to get more money to the fiscal. Even if you are going to increase the excise, that is not going to translate to an increase to the fiscal. So on our next slide, sir, what we are proposing is that there should be the government should implement a comprehensive audit to all manufacturers that for the past few months that there's been some arrests of people that are trafficking illicit cigarettes to our country. We have looked at that, Chair, but we believe that that is just a drop in the ocean. More and much must still be done. So, and the other thing that we are asking is that the government should ratify the WHO protocol, the WHO protocol that they signed in 2013 that seeks to eliminate illicit trading and enforce a minimum retail price that is above the MCT. By that we mean that because I've just mentioned that there are people are selling at 6 rand. So we are saying that MCT should be around 28 rand, because then it would assist the law enforcement agencies. And government must introduce a comprehensive track and trace system that would expose the criminals. With that, Chair, I don't want to waste your time. That is what we are appealing to, because we believe that if government can impose this will help our law enforcement agents, and then this will help also this struggling our business is struggling as the state, and our economy is struggling, and this will help to get more money to the fiscals, not to the criminals. I thank you.
Thanks very much, Mr. Mthumi, and also in a very few minutes. Move to Mr. Philip Morris. Now it's 9:36, so you have got 10 minutes up to 40 minutes. Over to you, Mr. Philip.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and to the honourable members of the committee. My name is Nitesh Ramji. I represent Philip Morris South Africa, and our parent company, Philip Morris International, has embarked on a transformation which we call a smoke-free future. We intend to stop selling cigarettes in the future, and we've set ourselves a target of by 2025 having more than 50% of our revenue globally from reduced risk products, and to sell these products in more than 100 markets around the world. We are more than halfway already with that set of targets. And I would like to illustrate to the members, if you can see me, what I mean by the reduced risk products or heated tobacco products, which are excised in terms of tariff item 2403.99.90 and 2403.99.05, which is in Schedule 2, Part 1, Section 5. So we refer to a device which you insert a consumable which contains tobacco, but the tobacco is not burnt. There is no combustion. So it is a reduced risk product, as has been evidenced by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA in the US, that went through the science and the evidence and classed this product as a modified risk tobacco product. I wanted to raise 3 points today in my comments. The first relates to the base for the taxation of these products. I commented last year as well on the draft rates bill, and we made a submission that the base should be on the net tobacco weight of the consumable and not the full weight of the consumable. The reason for saying this is that the tobacco portion is just a small part of the total consumable. And also, this is a new and evolving category of products where the consumables come in different shapes and formats. So what happened in the draft bill this year is that a new category was created for products which come in a stick form, and the old category of the full weight of the consumable was also kept. It is our submission that there should be a single base which will cater for any type of consumable that gets introduced into the market, and that the common denominator of the tobacco weight is what is used to calculate the excise. The second point which I would like to raise, which is also incorporated in our written submission, is that the principle that is being followed around the world is that higher risk products are taxed at a higher rate. At the moment, that has been acknowledged by Treasury, as there is a 25% differential between heated tobacco products, excise, and cigarettes. And on average, if you look at the rates applied in EU countries, that is a 72% differential versus the 25% differential. So if the principle is accepted that harm reduction is the way to go and that fiscal policy can be used to incentivize smokers to switch to better alternatives, it is our proposal that we revisit the rate of excise and that the excise on non-combustible products be lower than the lowest rate for combustible products, which currently is pipe tobacco. The third part of my submission today relates to the fact that the excise on heated tobacco products is pegged to the excise on cigarettes. So as I mentioned earlier, there's the 25% differential between heated tobacco product excise and cigarettes. But we believe that these should be decoupled because it's a separate and distinct category, and what happens in the cigarette category should not affect the rate at which heated tobacco products are excised. So that is, in a nutshell, my submission. We would like to see a single base of taxation for all heated tobacco products, whatever shape or format, that being the net tobacco weight. We would like to see if Treasury can revisit the rate of taxation to incentivize smokers to switch to these less harmful products. And we would also like to see the category being treated as distinct from cigarettes. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Ramji. I thought Philip Morris is the name of the president. The name of the
president. Correct.
Thanks, Mr. Ramji. Honorable members, the first category of presenters was on tobacco. Alan Tebuko, you'll assist me with members who are raising hands in the platform. Do you have members who want to ask clarity-seeking questions or make comments?
So far, there's no hands, Chair.
We have taken quite a number of resolutions as this committee in the past in regard to clamping down illicit tobacco business or trading. Is it possible, Alan, that we can track those resolutions first to check as to how far are we to make sure that they are implemented? Because I remember at some stage SARS raised quite a number of measures that they are implementing to curb on this tobacco business, where there are a lot of illicit traders. And the issue of track and trace was raised sharply. And I can't remember what was the explanation of SARS not to implement this measure. Can we, when SARS and Treasury respond, be in the position to have all those resolutions on it, including what the police have indicated they are doing in this regard, or the law enforcement agencies in general, so that we don't say the same thing and we don't get the feedback from law enforcers and SARS as to what's happening? Because I remember, seemingly it was British VAT which said that they even know where the warehouses of these illicit tobacco traders are, and why there was no raid on those warehouses, nobody can explain. So can you track all those resolutions, Alan, of the committee, so that in the next meeting with SARS and Treasury, they have to explain to us as to how far are we in regard to clamping down on all the illicit trading. So if we can do that, then return Francois van der Merwe.
Good morning, Chair. Can you hear me?
How are you?
Morning, morning, Chair. Can you hear me?
Where are you from, Francois?
Good morning, Chair. I presented many times to you in the committee. You will remember me. I'm still involved in the industry and I'm still a tobacco farmer, and I hope you and your colleagues are all well.
Hi, Francois. You know the rules much better than anybody. You have been to Cape Town several times. You will make comments next week. When are we meeting again? Remember, now we are giving you space to present. So now is the time for members. Then when Treasury and SARS responds, we'll allocate you space to engage the response from Treasury and SARS. I hope you understand the rules.
No, it's fine, Chair. I just wanted to give the committee some hope and some help, but it's fine. I abide by your rules, Chair. That's fine.
When we come to that platform, either next week or a week after next, come with that information. I think it was you who raised that matter sharply, that you even know the warehouses of illicit traders.
Exactly. We know exactly, Chair, so we can help Parliament, but that's fine, Chair. Thank you very much.
I remember you raised it. I think we were in all the same place when...
Yes. Yes.
I remember.
Thank you, Chair.
So you will raise all those issues next week or a week after next session.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thanks, Francois. Let's move to the next category. The liquor, now, agriculture, banking, liquor. Okay. The first in this category is South African Liquor Brand Owners Association, SALBA.
Chair, sorry to interrupt, but SALBA asked if they can join like literally 5 minutes before their presentation because they've got another engagement. I don't know if you want to move on to the next, and then I'll just get hold of SALBA to say they are up.
Okay. It's SA in the platform. Agri SA, are you ready? Alan and Tevo, do we have Agri SA available? If not, let's go to...
Everybody, good morning, Chair. I am available.
Oh, okay.
I just want to share my... screen if it's possible.
Yeah, I think you can co-share with Alan. It's 9:49 now, 10 o'clock on 9:59, you should be done. Over to you, Agreste.
Thank you, Chair. I just need the host to disable the participant screen sharing. I just need to share my presentation, if that's possible.
Alan, can you...
Chair, I've done that. I've made him co-host. So from his side, he can project. If not, I can do it from my side.
No, it's fine. I do have it available. Let me just get to the presentation. Okay, I will be ready just now. Chair, may I ask that the gentleman on your side? Okay, I've got it. So, Chair, thanks very much for this opportunity. Agri-SA obviously represents a large portion of commercial agriculture in South Africa, and we work very hard at securing an inclusive, prosperous agriculture sector. And then our mission is to promote agriculture in South Africa, to encourage its development, and to make it more profitable, stable, and sustainable. So we represent approximately 16,000 commercial producers, 26 commodity organizations, and 56 corporate members. Now, we specifically make submission in respect of the following proposed amendments to the income tax. That's section 20 of the ITA. That relates to the set-off of assessed losses. Definition of the contributed tax capital in section 1 of the Income Tax Act, and then section 7C of the ITA. In addition, we also make submissions in respect of the proposed amendment to Part B of Schedule 2, that relates to the Value Added Tax Act, whereof it has been proposed that the schedule will be amended to include superfine maize meal in a list of grades of maize meal that qualify for zero rating. But our most critical submission relates to the proposed change to Section 20 of the ITA, paragraph 4.1, and it sets out how the proposed amendment will negatively impact the agriculture sector and hinder South Africa's economic recovery and food security. Now, there are various reasons why the proposed change specifically affects the agriculture sector, but the two most critical aspects are the cyclicality of farming. As you know, one year you've got a drought, the next year you've got commodity prices that are going through the roof, and at the same time you've got input costs that vary from one year to the other. This year specifically we are faced with massive increases in fertilizer costs due to the disruptions in the global trade logistics network, and also due to the fact that we face other problems within the broader global economic context. And then, farming requires long-term investment, and I'll come to that later on. But let's deal with the first matter. Now, the National Treasury has proposed amendments to Section 20 of the Act to limit the offsetting of accumulated assessed losses carried forward by taxpayers to 80% of the amount of taxable income derived by the taxpayer. Per the draft EM 2021, proposed amendment has been proposed to inter alia improve the country's competitiveness, reduce the appeal of base erosion and profit shifting, encourage investment and promote economic growth. In respect of companies with long lead time between investment and the realization of profits, draft EM 2021 provides that the limitation of offsetting of assessed losses should have a lesser impact than the limitation of the carry forward period to a set number of years. Now, Agri-SA wants to put the following recommendations on the table. The proposed amendment would, in our view, create an undue burden on taxpayers in the agriculture sector, and we recommend that the proposed amendment not be implemented. Secondly, alternatively, we suggest we suggest that the National Treasury not forge ahead with this proposed amendment during the current legislative cycle. Greater consultation, and I want to emphasize this, greater consultation and greater understanding of the agriculture sector is required to understand the full impact of this proposed amendment. In this regard, we as AgriSA have not had an opportunity to consult extensively with our members and affiliates or to prepare financial models, forecasts and or other supporting evidence in respect of the effects of the proposed amendment. Further consultation is necessary to clarify the application of the amendment, amended Section 20 and Section 26 of the Act as read with the first schedule to the Act. And then as a last resort, do we recommend that the proposed amendment to Section 20 excludes all companies trading as primary farming companies, which could be linked to VAT registration that is specific to farming operations. However, we note that this may not cover all farming operations carried on in companies, as some micro or small business farmers conducting farming to a company may not be registered for VAT. Now, those are our core recommendations, and I want to just share a few slides with you. Our rainfall patterns in South Africa is very erratic. This is one of the driest countries in the world. And yes, we had a very good rain season last year, and it's predicted that this year will also be a very good raining year. But as you know, maybe in 2023-24, we can expect very dry conditions again. And then farmers sit with massive production loans that they can't cover, and they sit with massive losses. So within this context, our appeal is therefore to just put a hold on the introduction of this amended Section 20. There you see, whilst agriculture has contributed tremendously to economic growth, at the same time, South Africa produces food on the back of debt. In other words, our farmers are highly indebted with our financial institutions. You know about the challenges, the liquidity challenges that is currently being experienced by the land bank. The big question now is, where will those farmers find assistance if the land bank cannot help them out? And that in itself poses a security threat or food security threat to South Africa. Yes, at the same time, while the profit margins are very low in farming and the profit squeeze every year takes on a different character, as I've said, it can be drought, it can be biosecurity problems, it can be a fall in commodity prices, it can be a rise in input costs, we've seen it still create jobs. According to the latest statistics SA, we've seen agriculture creating in the region of 860,000 jobs. Then the big issue is the long time it takes, especially for long-term crops, to come into fruition. Now, we're in the process of establishing a big cohort of black commercial farmers. Sir, many of these farmers do not have the capital to sustain themselves for a period of 7 to 8 years before nut trees, orange trees, or any apple trees, pear trees start to produce any fruit. And that's the big dilemma that we face in agriculture. It is not a sector that produces profits within year one. It is a long lead time. At the same time, the little profit that you create can easily be eroded due to factors beyond your control. If you look at the gross value of horticulture and animal products, the figures there, there's a story to tell. Gross value to total farming debt for 2017-2018 sits at 1.11, and we face tremendous challenges within that space. The same applies to field crops, and the same applies to any other crops that we produce. But this is a very, very important slide that I quickly want to raise. So African commercial farmers are the saving grace of South Africa. They've been producing top quality food during the lockdown period, and they continue to do so. We produce food for export purposes for the rest of the world, and we secure food security not only for South Africa but for the entire southern region. But say, if you look at this slide, it tells you a very sad story, that our producers get very little support in the form of subsidies. If you compare us with the United States, farmers in Europe, farmers in many other countries, those farmers get are highly subsidized. So our farmers must compete with those farmers. And yes, despite the lack of support that our farmers get in terms of subsidies and so forth, we still maintain a competitive edge. So our appeal today is that let us maintain that competitive edge and let us bring our black farmers on board, because given the nature and context of agriculture, those are the farmers that will suffer tremendously, and we will not achieve the outcome of land reform and the establishment of a new code of black farmers if we implement Section 20 and we do not give them a cushion on which they can fall back in terms of carry over any losses from one tax year to the other. Then, last but not least, that is my contribution. I'm not sure Kulani Sewea, who is our chief economist, if Kulani wants to perhaps add anything, and if we still have a bit of time, just to share a few thoughts with you, Kulani.
Thank you very much, Krista. Good morning to everyone. Good morning, Chair. And I think Krista covered the fundamentals that we stand on as AgriSA. And I think one of the driving factors that Krista also mentioned is just how unstable the sector is in terms of just realizing profits. Whenever there's any shock that happens to the market itself, it takes a long time for farmers themselves to realize any firmer footing after that. So after a year or two of drought, especially in cases like the Karoo, where they've experienced about 8 years of drought, it won't take 1 year for them to come back on a firm footing again. It will take a very long time. So the sector does need a breathing space in order for them to get back to sustainability, get back to being viable once again. And such taxation dispensations do aid the sector itself in making sure that it becomes viable and competitive. And I think Krista's alluded to many of those factors, and we would hope that we'd have a favorable consideration from the department and SARS in this regard. Other than that, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Kulani. And I don't know, Simon Weber, our tax expert, if you want to add something.
No, good morning, everyone. So I think you guys summed it up quite well. So nothing further from ENS.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity. We are done.
Okay. Thanks, Christo, and your team from AgriSA. Dr. Shope, are you here?
Zakele sent me a message earlier just to say that he's got a burst water pipe that he needs to deal with. He is running around trying to fix that, but he will join the meeting when he can.
Is Antonio here? Because I wanted the research team to check something. There are issues that the SA are raising, of course, on the basis of tax debate, but which are also related to the agri policy in relation to subsidies. So I would want the research team to look at that so that when we meet in the next round, where Treasury and SARS will be responding, we have got clarity as to what is the position of government in relation to issues that they are raising. So that we debate within the context of what is in the policy in regard to issues of farmer subsidies. Who's ready now, Alan? Is Salba ready, or we go to Agbiz? How do you spell this?
Yes, Chair. Salba is here. I think Kurt Moore has let in earlier, and then after them is BASA, not the Banking Association, but the Beer Association of South Africa.
Okay. Is Dr. Mueller here?
Yes, he's online too.
Okay. So we start with Salva.
That's great, Chair.
Okay. Salva, are you ready now?
We are, Chair. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Do we share the presentation, or will that be shared on your side?
I'll just make you co-host quickly. Kurt, I've given you access. Let me know if you have any difficulty.
Thank you. Are you seeing what I'm seeing?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the committee for the opportunity today to present to the committee. I think we're acutely aware of the time constraints that we have together. We just have a few slides to present. All the information contained in these slides are backed up by independent research, and we're really more than willing to share that detailed report that underpins our submission. My name is Kurt Moore. I'm the CEO of Salva. I'm joined today by my value chain partner in the form of Vinpro, Mr. Christo Conradi. He's on this call. Some of my members have also joined the call. We've got Ms. Ravashini Govender from Distel, Ms. Sina Makwevo from Diageo, and Ms. Pamela Nkuna from Pamela Record. What we hope to take you through today is our economic contribution. We'll look in very briefly at the impact of the ban on alcohol, how that has influenced illicit trade, and then talk you through the tax incidents and how these influence each other. And we'll then conclude with some Q&A if we have some time. So thank you, Chair. Let me just quickly introduce ourselves. Vinpro is the representative trade association representing South African wine producers, the farmers, as well as sellers, whereas Salva is further down in the value chain. We represent manufacturers and distributors of liquor in the industry. Our membership cuts across all liquor categories, including wine, spirits, ciders, and other ready-to-drink beverages. Just briefly then, to look at the industry contribution to the South African economy. This is a pretty very busy slide, but I'll quickly talk you through it. The industry and its value chain contributes almost 200 billion rand in GDP. Those are 2019 figures, and the reason we use 2019 figures, Chair, is because that's the most complete year we have to date. We all know about 2020 and even 2021, so the most reliable data is from 2019. Within that, 72 billion rand in indirect taxes goes into government's coffers. We make a contribution in terms of jobs, but the most important quadrant here is the lower right column, which is the multiplier effect. You know, if we consider all the key indicators in terms of multipliers, employment, GDP multiplier, labor to capital ratio, all those within our sector, those multipliers outperform the South African economy. But whenever we discuss our contribution to the South African economy, we're always challenged by the harm that is caused as a result of the abuse of the product. So this is important also to position. As industry, we're committed to working with government to tackle the harm related to irresponsible consumption of alcohol. Our plan is to invest, and we're currently in that plan, 1 billion rand over 5 years to address that. These are the three focus areas: binge drinking and driving. There we're working with the Department of Transport and also to tackle underage drinking. If we then go on to the cumulative impact of the bans on the alcohol industry over the last 2 years, once again, another busy slide, so I'll talk you through it. But if we look at the impact, and this is right up until the most recent ban, we've lost about 15.7% of our sales volumes, or 1.3 million litres. It also has had the impact in terms of the fiscus. There's an incredible impact on the fiscus, with 64.8 billion rand lost to the GDP. And then we have some jobs at risk in the region of about 250,000 30,000 because of all these bans. If we then consider moving on to the still dealing with the impact of the bans and in terms of taxes, 36.4 billion rand lost in revenue to Treasury. And then excise tax, which we're coming to in a moment, there's a loss of about 10.9 billion rand, almost 11 billion rand in terms of excise revenue. These bans have had a direct correlation with illicit trade. We've done some research by Euromonitor, and as I mentioned earlier, we're happy to share that full research report with this committee. But if we look at illicit trade and just a glance at it, it accounts at this stage for about 22% of the total market in terms of volume, 12% in terms of value, but that's almost 20 billion rand, or just over 20 billion rand. And then the loss to the fiscus, 11.3 billion rand, is the estimate. And that's grown since 2017 by 20%, compare it to the 2017 figures. And at the root cause, or one of the key drivers of illicit trade, according to the report by Euromonitor, is taxation strategies. And certainly, the taxation strategies plays a role on illicit trade. The higher the tax incidences are within for our products, the more space we create for illicit operators, and the more lucrative we actually make it. So let's then go on to the reason for our discussion to the tax incidents. More specifically, if you look at the draft bill, the excise incidents we'd like to hone in on today. Now, in 2014-2015, government set itself a policy framework, and that policy framework aimed to reach a tax incidence for beer of 23%, for still wine of 11%, and for spirits of 36%. We all know in February 2021, on the 24th of February, the most recent Minister of Finance, Mr. Mboweni, announced that excise will increase by 8%. At that stage, CPI or inflation was around about half of that, just hovering around 4.2%. So that's almost double the going inflation rate. It then resulted in, as at 20th of August, when we did this review, that a tax incidence for beer at 26%, for wine at 12.2%, and for spirits at 41.96%, clearly above the government's own policy framework that they've set for themselves. So what is our ask today, Jay? I think what we're saying to the Standing Committee and to government in general is that while both Treasury and the alcohol industry faces significant challenges, we think that with a bit more policy certainty, we can help to grow this economy again. And right now, being outside the policy framework that which government itself set, government should be taking active steps to demonstrate that they want to return to its policy framework. And that may mean over the short term to possibly freeze or pass excise increases below inflation, but if we continue on this trend, we're just going to continue to go further and further beyond. As I said, the more we increase taxes, the more space we create and the better margins we create for illicit traders. So we've got to keep the money in the legal industry, because ultimately our fiscus, we believe, will grow and benefit from that. Then just finally, in the last slide, I think in the 2020 policy or medium-term budget policy statement by the then Minister of Finance, he spoke of this policy certainty and saying that investors want policy certainty. Policy certainty for investors creates a fertile ground for investment and growth in our sector. And we want to echo the views expressed by the previous presenter that we need to have some substantive consultation and dialogue with Treasury and with the Standing Committee as the government considers its excise policy options going forward. Chair, I hope I've done justice to the presentation. We have a number of other slides. That's all information to support this presentation. It's not necessary for me to go into that. We are available for questions. And as I said, if you require the detailed reports that underpin the submission, we're happy to supply that via Mr. Wickham's office. I have my other colleagues on the line in the few minutes that we have available. I don't know if you'd like to add anything, but if not, we thank you for the opportunity, Chair.
Thank you, Kurt. We don't have much time today. As you can see, there are many presenters. You will be afforded time when SARS and Treasurer come back with their responses. We'll still have time to ask questions. Who's next, Alan? Is it Agbiz or Dr. Sean Muller or who else?
No, Chair. Next up is BASA. That's the Beer Association of South Africa. The Banking Association is a bit later on in the program.
Oh, there are two BASA. There's BASA Beer and BASA Benz. Okay.
Yes, Chair.
They share acronyms. The Beer Association, are you ready?
Thank you, Chair. We are ready, and thank you for the time. We'll go straight into it. The Beer Association slides.
You are the first woman to present in the Women's Month. It's there are so many men who have been delegated here. Over to you, Patricia.
Thank you, Chair, and we proudly women in the Beer Association. Thank you so much. Gregory Marks, if we can please allow him share screen, please, so he can help us drive. Thank you so much. But while we're doing that, Gregory, are you able to share?
Patricia, I'm just waiting for the convener to allow me to share.
Gregory, I've just made you co-host.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much to you, Chair, and the Portfolio Committee. I think it's very important that I do a quick round of introductions. As you heard, Patricia Pillay from the Beer Association of South Africa, and you're quite right, we should have been careful with our acronym because we often get confused for banking. But with me today from the BASA team is Gregory Marks. He's part of our excise team. We have Fatani Banda, who is part of our SAB team, and she deals particularly with excise at SAB. And then we also have Millicent Marocca. She was having a problem getting into the waiting room, so we'll just check up, but we can proceed with Alta, but she is from our Heineken team. So we are happy to be here today to just take you through from a beer perspective where some of our challenges lie and where we can have some opportunities. So I think that most importantly for us, what we will cover today, and we can move to the next slide, is the sharing of what it is the impact has mainly on our craft brewers. And we'll go through who our membership is now. And as you've heard, there is SAB, there is Heineken, and our craft brewers. Unfortunately, our chair of our craft brewer association is not available for the call today, but it would have been lovely to also hear her story. But our craft brewers are over 200 brewers in South Africa. We are a large footprint of family-owned businesses that employ a minimum of 10 people, and the impact of the bans have really affected them in terms of closures, and I will go through that in detail. Then we will go through a very quick slide deck in terms of the intention of excise duties and are we really achieving that in the current format. We've had to pivot quite a lot in terms of this new normal, and my colleague Fatani will take us through the excise duties tax incidents over the past 5 years, as well as the impact then further on the value chain, and that includes all the way from barley to bar, and then the unintended consequences. And my colleague Kurt from Salva has covered some of that. We've done some research, as he's mentioned, in terms of the illicit trade. And the last slide in terms of survival and recovery of the beer value chain, which is really what I want to stress on today. So I want to just take you through a screenshot of our membership. And you can see here the SAB, the Craft Brewers Association, and Heineken. We are a new association. We were formed in 2019, but it was in the interest of predominantly making sure that the craft brewers are properly represented and have a voice in the beer sector. In terms of our supply chain, I thought it is important to take a few minutes to go through this. As you can see, our value chain moves all the way from agriculture in terms of the barley, the hops, the yeast, and the water. And you can see in my background as well is the beautiful hops that we use in terms of this and these wonderful projects that we have undergo where people are even growing, young black entrepreneurs are growing barley on rooftops in the Johannesburg CBD. And it's a really wonderful agricultural opportunity. You've also seen in terms of yeast, Marmalade, for example, which is a brand we all know in South Africa, has been taking strain because of the lack of beer manufacturing and processing that is going on at the moment. We move then into malting, where you convert the barley into the malt. And we have to also mention that any of our wastage is not wasted. It goes to pig farmers who rely on us in terms of our waste. It then goes on to the brewing, which is the raw materials where we turn that into beer. And at this process, what we've also explored, which I do want to mention, is moving into a no low alcohol beer. And with no alcohol, it is then made sure that extraction takes place at this point. And it's very important for our later narrative with SARS and Treasury. And then packaging, which is where our console glasses, et cetera, get affected. And you will see later on where we talk about millions of rands of investment that has been lost. We then move to distribution, which is then our transport and our fleet, our careers, who have all been impacted. And then we move to the customer. But in between this is all our service providers, our advertising agencies, our various marketing people that we use, our sales agents on the ground that have all been impacted, including then the bars, the restaurants, and clubs, and then sold to the consumer in moderation, which is something that we push. So I thought it was important we go through that before I'm able to share with you the next slide, which is really our contribution as beer. My Salbert colleagues have went through the alcohol aggregate in terms of contribution. And I think it is important to highlight also from a beer perspective, we contribute 1.53% to the GDP. That number has also grown. This is the latest 2019. A new study is being commissioned. The total GDP contribution was over 387 billion, and this is from beer alone. The excise tax revenue, 25.1 billion, a number also that has increased. And the number of jobs has increased from 2018 to double. So we're looking at over 450,000 jobs that are in the beer industry alone at the moment, with the national employment of 1.4%. And with the high unemployment rate, we know that this is something that is very close to all of our hearts to ensure that especially our youth are getting jobs at the moment. Our contribution to the township economy is estimated 255,000 people. So I think this is just to highlight that as here we do play a significant role and we do need to take care of our value chain. And one of the ways is to take care of them in terms of some kind of relief. The part that we will mention later on, Chair, which I do think we need to mention, is as the beer industry, especially our craft brewers, have not received relief. They have not have got qualified for URF TERS. We've actually raised it with URF in terms of having a meeting. There were over 400 people that were on the call complaining to URF saying, why are we being rejected as alcohol? We do not qualify for any tourism levies. We do not qualify for any grants. We also, when the president announced about the license exemptions, when we also said to our liquor board, well, we have a license exemption, we were told it does not apply to alcohol. And really, for our craft brewers, it is really untenable, and we do need some form of relief. And this is why we come to you, hoping that you are the relief that can be offered. If you look at what the excise duty increase and how it affects us, is it also affects the investor sentiment. And unfortunately, our Heineken plant and our colleague Millicent is on the call now, as you can see. Her plant in KZN, unfortunately, was halted. It was 6 billion capital investment with over 1,400 jobs that were not put placed. And then SAB production plant, it was over 5 billion rand capital investment that went to another country in Africa. Unfortunately, we do want that in our country as much as we support the AU. And then the console investment, like I spoke about, it's more than $2.1 billion because we are their key customer. So when production stops for us, it actually stops for them as well. So, Chair, I really think that this is really a snapshot also in our submission of why it's so important that we get some kind of relief and we do not continue with the trajectory, as we've seen, of the 8%, which is almost double in terms of, if you look at it, the variance of 3.72% in terms of the inflation rate, and a cumulative here of 17.23%. And we're asking at this time for that to be reconsidered. So the growth of illicit economy will be covered by my colleague Fatsani, and we can move on then to just share with you the further going forward from Fatsani in terms of the slides. Thanks, Fatsani.
Thanks, Patricia. Thanks, Honourable Chair, for giving us the opportunity to present. Just to highlight, basically at a high level, excise taxes imposed by National Treasury and administered by SARS is intended to maintain a constant stream of revenue for the state and to discourage harmful consumption amongst the population. Internationally, this has been differentiated, and we've seen this in the tax incident rate. However, an above inflation increase that we've experienced in this year has allowed, was applied as a blanket increase, and it's really had negative effects, as Patricia has highlighted, throughout the beer industry. Next slide. So this is just a reiteration of the position on the variance between the excise duty and the excise rate. Government has acknowledged in its excise policy framework of 2014 that the inflation rate and that the excise annual adjustment has been above inflation. Outside of this, we want to stress that there is a continued deviation between the policy and its implementation that has continued to affect the business viability of our craft brewers as BASA for SAB and as for Heineken. Next slide. So the trend analysis from 2017 to 2021 sees a cumulative variance of 17.22%. At face value, this might just be an excise variance that is applied to the brewery, but this is not so. This has affected certainty and transparency around whether we can continue to increase our investments. As Patricia highlighted, investments have been stopped over 2020 as well as on the 2021 financial year because we don't have enough transparency and certainty around the implementation of X5 based on the 2014 framework. This ultimately has an effect on how consumers respond to price changes. Prices that are too high or the distortion that excise creates on market prices for companies that are legal, selling legal alcohol, now have to compete with, for instance, the illicit market. So that competition based off price allows customers to substitute away to illegal alcohol, or alcohol that is not safe for their consumption. Next slide. So this is just a deep dive into the illicit alcohol and its growth. So the Euromonitor report, which was commissioned and the results explained in 2021, shows that the market share of illicit alcohol has increased by 22% by volume. This is a 12% jump in terms of value, and the fiscal loss to Treasury and to the government is 11.3 billion rand. So legal alcohol is now having to think about their competitiveness in terms of price subject to what is going on in the illicit alcohol market, which is not the initial intention of excise. Excise is supposed to be a tax on consumption behavior and a means for the government to increase revenue and not to create competitive market conditions which put the legal alcohol market in competition with, for instance, prices in the illicit alcohol market. We would not like a circumstance where consumers see cheaper alternatives in unregulated alcohol, and we would reiterate the point that legal alcohol needs to remain at the center of the alcohol market and not have to deal with what is going on in the fringes and increasing, which is what the growth in the illicit alcohol market is a reflection of. Next slide. So importantly, and I think Patricia will go back to this, is what she mentioned is the survival and recovery of the beer value chain due to the pandemic and also due to the craft brewers. Patricia, you can perhaps highlight some of the points that you reiterated in the beginning of the presentation.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Patani. And I think, Chair and to Portfolio Committee, you know, our plea really is to consider us. I think really we're at a point now, we're just fighting for survival, and we want to ensure that we do not decimate an industry that really has focus on transformation, promoting young brewers. We are involved in many projects in terms of making sure that people are educated in terms of proper brewing, setting up their businesses, etc. And, you know, this 8% excise duty increase will really be counterproductive to our recovery and proceeding in terms of our strategies going forward. In terms of the final slide, thank you for the time. It is really to look at the reflection of the tax incidents like we spoke about in the past 5 years, and in order to show that this 17.23% cumulative deviation is really a deviation from government's tax policy. The impact of the excise duty increases on that entire value chain that I showed you on the slide is ultimately absorbed by that consumer, who then looks at substitution and doesn't look at necessarily the quality of the product. And we've all seen in the headlines, etc., that people were then drinking substances that led to their deaths. And this is something that we cannot continue and allow to continue. And these are the unintended consequences, that people will then move into this illicit economy, and that the beer industry also has to look at the SMMEs and how is it, and that's how we can help in terms of at least giving them. There was some deferment and that did help, but unfortunately they need more than that at this time. And there is definitely an appeal from BASA for further collaboration and certainty with Treasury for inclusivity in review of policy framework. So I think we thank everyone for their time, and I'm happy to take any questions with the team. Thank you, Chair.
Oh, okay. No, I was worried that you were still having more slides. We know that this is your month as women, but so we have to respect you and allocate you more time. Thanks, Patricia and Fatan. Alan, who's available now?
Chair, next up is Agbiz, and I think Theo is online.
Agbiz, are you there?
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. We are here, and good morning, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, and esteemed guests. So my name is Steve Wasser, from the Head of Legal Intelligence at ACBIS. We won't be giving a formal presentation, but we'll just an oral input based on our written submission given yesterday, and we do just urge members also to look at the detail of that submission. So by way of an introduction, I think you wanted...
Now is that you... I'm saying that you have 10 minutes to present, as you know, as we have made it clear right at the beginning.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. It is appreciated. Our focus for today will be largely focused on Section 20 of the Amendment Bill, which focuses on the cap on losses carried forward. So we believe that much of the presentation has already been covered by colleagues this morning, so we'll definitely stay within the 10 minutes. Perhaps just an introduction to our organization. So we are a voluntary association of businesses operating in agricultural value chains, typically upstream and downstream value chains. So that includes input providers, in other words, those companies that manufacture and sell seeds, fertilizers, etc. Also on the off-taking side, from agro-processing to logistics companies, storage and handling companies, etc., as well as, quite importantly, companies that finance these inputs and outputs for the primary agricultural sector, as well as commodity organizations. We're also a member of Business Unity South Africa, and we definitely support the comprehensive input that they've also submitted. Chairperson, so coming from an overarching view of agricultural value chains, as I mentioned, our focus is on Section 20 of the Amendment Bill, the capping the amount of losses that can be forwarded to 80%. So I think it's important to acknowledge that the National Treasury is in a very tight fiscal space, and we certainly support the concept of broadening the tax base. However, we are somewhat concerned that the means in which this is applied might disproportionately affect the agricultural sector, and it might not be offset, or the impact might not be offset by a reduction in the general corporate tax. So a lot of the taxpayers are already in quite a tight space, reading from the economic downturn last year due to the COVID restrictions, when there was a negative growth rate of 6.4 4%, according to Stats SA, from April 2020 to April 2021. So, and many businesses have, of course, experienced considerable losses. Quite importantly, is many of the much of the fiscal assistance that was provided by National Treasury, and I think certainly appreciated by companies, did allow the deferment of certain payments of taxes or certain or the guarantee scheme that allowed businesses to access greater credit to ride out the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, importantly, we do believe going forward, of course, this will need to be paid back. So one does see a high level of debt in the agricultural value chain and wider economy as well. So when the economic conditions do turn around, as they are currently busy turning around, it's very important that these companies are able to maximize this to the full, to be able to repay this debt, to get back into the even footing they were before the COVID-19 pandemic. Just focusing on agriculture specifically, and many of my colleagues have already set the scene very well in this regard, it is cyclical in nature. Now, agriculture was, of course, on the whole, one of the sectors that were less affected, with a notable exception, of course, of our colleagues in the liquor and the wine industries, who were severely affected by the COVID-19 pandemic, but on agriculture in the broader space was less affected. And there was a positive growth rate of about 13%, which is primarily down to favorable weather conditions, and as I mentioned, less strict lockdowns or restrictions being in the COVID-19 pandemic. This can, however, be somewhat misleading, as many sectors of agriculture, especially in the Western Cape more recently, but going back to 2015-16, even the summer planting areas did come out of sustained drought conditions where losses were experienced. Agriculture, as my colleagues have mentioned, is cyclical in nature, where it goes through cycles of losses and profits, and it largely reflects weather conditions. So the ability to be able to set off these losses in years where the climate is more favorable is absolutely critical. And this is a knock-on effect, not just for primary agriculture, not just for farming, but for agricultural businesses. Agriculture, of course, the primary sector contributes 2-3% of GDP. However, when it's taken with the entire agricultural value chain, all the companies that do business with agriculture, one gets to a figure of closer to 14%. And so it will definitely have this knock-on effect. From a financing point of view, as many of the agribusinesses, of course, finance the inputs for primary agriculture, it is quite important they do rely on agriculture, on the primary sector, to be able to take advantage, full advantage, of profitable seasons, such as the previous season and the current season, to repay many of these losses. If the amount of losses carried forward is capped in the manner that is proposed by Section 20 of the Amendment Bill, it will certainly hamper the sector's ability to do so, and it will have this knock-on effect on financing as well as, of course, the agricultural business sector right throughout, up and down the value chains. The National Development Plan, as well as the Agriculture and Agro-Processing Master Plan, places a lot of emphasis on export-led inclusive growth through the agricultural sector. Much of this comes from specifically long-standing crops such as the horticultural sector, for instance, orchards, etc. Now, these are characterized by a relatively long turnaround period from where investments are made towards when these investments do yield a return. Typically, in the horticultural sector, when new orchards or fruit orchards, for example, are planted, and horticulture, of course, being one of the largest export industries in South Africa, can be a lead time of up to 8 years before a return is realized on that investment. So, of course, capping the rollover or the assessed losses carried forward can have a very negative impact on this sort of investment, which is required to drive inclusive growth in the sector. So, Jefferson, again, I think we're not insensitive to the fact that we are in a constrained fiscal space, but there are a number of alternatives which one can look at, opposed to capping the amount of losses that are carried forward. For instance, I think either reducing government expenditure or focusing government expenditure on enablers to the economy, specifically expenditure on infrastructure, education, security services, and capacity building for key institutions that boost business confidence will certainly assist. There is also mention made in the explanatory memorandum that the purpose is to broaden the tax base by lowering the corporate tax rates. In other words, making it more conducive for collecting taxes from small businesses. So So there's some, the concentration economy is often met with stricter competition laws, but unfortunately this can overlook the regulatory burden that small businesses are currently faced with. So having a critical review of the regulatory burden, how it disproportionately affects small businesses and leads towards concentration in certain industries, I think would be a fiscal neutral alternative as well that can be looked at. Finally, one potential way of looking at, and we come from the agricultural sector, but there are other sectors that are also significantly climate exposed. And these climate exposed industries will be disproportionately affected as their incomes are cyclical in nature as they're linked with climate change. And climate change, of course, is all indications are that it will increase in South Africa, increase the frequency of extreme weather events such as droughts or floods and these sort of natural disasters. So in a way to adapt to climate change, it might be a consideration to perhaps exempt either partially or fully climate-exposed industries from the cap on assessed losses carried forward. Jefferson, if more time is permitted or if there's a second round of public consultations, we would also welcome the opportunity to work with some of the partners in the industry to do economic modeling to see what effect it could have on the Treasury if certain climate-exposed industries were exempted, as well as what effect it could have on the primary industry if it, and the secondary agriculture industry if they are not exempted or if the 80% cap is kept there. In other words, modeling to see what the potential economic consequences can be. Jefferson, I think in a nutshell that summarizes our input, as it largely does build on what some of our other colleagues from the agricultural sector have also added. So we thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks, Theo, for the presentation, for the submission. Okay. Alan, is Dr. Mula available?
Yes, Jay is. I'll just give him co-host permission and then he can flight his presentation.
Chairperson and honourable members, can you hear me?
Yes, Dr. Mula, you have got 10 minutes. Now it's 10:42.
Great.
By 10. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Greetings to the honourable members and colleagues. Chairperson, I'm going to focus on just one issue pertaining to the draft tax bills. There are many issues on which I do have thoughts, some of which have been raised by industry representatives. There are broader questions which hopefully the committee will grapple with, such as why the National Treasury is not raising income or corporate taxes on citizens and firms that are able to contribute to alleviating the consequences of the pandemic and the economic downturn on the South Africans and small businesses that are suffering from that, but I'm not going to talk about that today. What I'm going to focus on is the employment tax incentive, and one of the reasons for that is that I've done some research on this over a number of years, and I did submit a recently published paper for the benefit of members, which gives a very lengthy overview of both the history of the employment tax incentive, both in the context of the South African economy and in the context of public policy, and essentially suggests that there wasn't a very strong case for the ETI at the outset, but also the subsequent evidence doesn't really support the notion that the ETI is having the desired effect on employment. So that's really what I want to talk about today, and in the context of the proposal from the National Treasury to make some minor amendments both to phrasing and to the implementation of the incentive to prevent abuse. Let me just make sure this is fits on the page. So the National Treasury has proposed a measure to address some problem is that the ECI is not likely to be achieving its objective in terms of reducing unemployment, which means, in effect, that it is instead serving as a subsidy to private companies. And I'll say a little bit more about what I mean by that in a later slide. Now, that conclusion is based on, as I've said, extensive analysis and research that I've done on the original basis for adopting and legislating the ETI, the supposed evidence that was used to support that decision, the parliamentary process both at the time and when the ETI was extended and expanded, and the evidence available since it was implemented. So it's not just just a mere opinion. It is actually based on a fairly extensive analysis, which has been peer reviewed and recently published. And so for members who are interested in the detail, I would suggest that you look at the paper, although I must caution you that it is a little bit long. So just to give you really an overview of the key points of that research paper, which was recently published in the Journal of Development and Change. First of all, that the evidence originally used to support the implementation of the ETI was either weak or it was flawed. And that's striking not in and of itself, but also because at the time, the narrative that was put forward by some of the researchers, by members of the media, and I would say perhaps some members of the National Treasury, was that the evidence was in fact extremely strong in support of the claim that an incentive of this kind would help to address unemployment. In other words, it would create new jobs. But a close examination of that evidence using my econometric knowledge and expertise doesn't support those claims about the original evidence. The paper also suggests that, and this is what I'm referring to when I talk about the sort of narrative, is that were misled about the strength and relevance of that evidence. So as an example, there was one experiment that was conducted, and it was intended to inform the policy decision. And the researchers claimed that experiment supported the idea that the incentive would reduce unemployment. That paper was not made available either, as far as I know, to Parliament or indeed to the general public or other academics such as myself, until after the decision had been made to implement, to legislate the ETI. And to my knowledge, it's never been published in any peer-reviewed outlet, and I think one of the reasons for that is that it doesn't actually support the conclusions that were claimed about the incentive. Similar kinds of issues, unfortunately, manifested in the decision and the process to renew and expand the ETI. So Parliament was supposed to have been presented with evidence on the efficacy, the available evidence on the efficacy of the ETI when it was extended in 2016, and that didn't happen. The National Treasury alluded to pieces of research that had been done, but none of the full pieces of research were made available at the time. I think I stand to be corrected, but certainly the last time I checked, none of them had been published in any peer-reviewed outlet. And even then, in fact, the evidence, only one of them really provided a claim that the ETI had been effective, and that was a paper that was co-authored by one of the individuals who'd originally advocated for the ETI and conducted that original experiment. The other ones were far more ambiguous. So in short, there was no definitive evidence that the ETI was in fact achieving its objective. And from that, the paper draws a further conclusion that the subsequent evidence, properly interpreted, does not support the claim that the ETI is having any significant effect on unemployment or is therefore fiscally justified. So just to give a brief explanation as to what's going on here, because some members may be a little bit puzzled by these claims, given the fact that the Treasury and SARS are effectively incurring billions of rands in tax expenditure firms can claim the incentive for workers that they would have employed anyway. So in other words, a firm that this year hires 20 qualifying people and the qualifying criteria are age and the salary that's being earned, amongst others, a firm that employs 20 people who qualify by those criteria this year can claim the incentive because those people meet the criteria, but that firm might have employed those individuals anyway. It may not be an employment decision that's a response to the incentive, but the state is obliged to pay because the individuals qualify. Now, that happens in almost all incentives of this kind, so in and of itself, that's not surprising. The issue is what proportion of the claims that are actually being made are of this kind. And if the vast majority of claims are of that type, then basically what's happening is that the state is incurring tax expenditure, it's losing tax revenue, but there is no corresponding increase in employment. And this was a very obvious concern at the outset, but one that wasn't really adequately addressed, and certainly from analysis of the parliamentary proceedings and so forth, wasn't really adequately presented and explained to members of parliament. It's often concealed under a technical term referred to as deadweight loss, and that's the term that Treasury used somewhere deep in one of their technical documents. So, oh yes, there might be a deadweight loss of a certain amount. But as I say, the evidence that's been available since the ETI was implemented appears to suggest that in fact the deadweight loss is the vast proportion of the subsidy, and abuse of the incentive of the kind that the Treasury mentioned in the draft tax bills is really just exacerbating that more fundamental problem. So when you combine the fact that companies are being paid for workers that they would have employed anyway, and in addition that there are companies that are abusing the incentive, recategorizing individuals and so forth to make them eligible, the conclusion is that it's actually not clear that any substantive number of new jobs are being created in response to the incentive, which is the purpose. Now, the National Development Plan, which members will be very familiar with, seeks to position South Africa as a developmental state, and the executive broadly has endorsed evidence-based policy and socioeconomic impact assessments. The National Treasury has been one of the drivers of both of these principles. And so the basic conclusion of the analysis is that on the basis of these principles, the employment tax incentive should actually be brought to an end. It's not achieving its objectives. It's costing billions in foregone tax revenue. And it's not hard to think of alternative uses for that money that we can be sure would create jobs. There are examples like the expanded public works program, but we also know that the government is reducing posts in frontline areas of social of service delivery because of the current fiscal situation. So in those kinds of situations, whatever the merits of the particular approach that's adopted, but what we do know is that we will actually, in fact, be able to count the number of jobs that are created as a result of redirecting these funds, whereas in the current case, what we can only do is do some econometric analysis to try and estimate what's happening, and so far, none of that analysis supports the claim that the ETI is, in fact, justified. So the purpose of this presentation really is to draw members' attention to this more fundamental question. Whether you deal with it now during the draft tax bills or not, but that is in fact the issue that needs to be addressed in relation to the ETI, not these fairly small changes to who qualifies and who doesn't and how the incentive is implemented and how it's not implemented. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Dr. Muller, for the presentation. You said you have written a paper on the ETI. Can you share it with our research team through Alan?
Yes, Shepherd. I have actually sent it to Alan, so I hope he will circulate it, but I can send it to again if needs be. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Now it's time for discussion. Yes, it's time for discussions. Honorable members, do you have clarity seeking questions? Do you have comments? Are there members who want to make comments or clarification questions, or the presentations were straightforward, they were clear. So it's for SARS and Treasury to respond in the next round. Okay. In the absence of hands, let's move to the next category, the financial sector. The other BASA now, not the PIA, the banking. Are you ready? Is BASA in the platform, Ale?
Good morning, Chair, and I'm not sure if let me hand over to Renee.
Good morning. Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you, Jeanette. And good morning, everybody. And thank you for this opportunity to come in and present. By way of introduction, my name is Itirele Nkubeka, and I'm on this forum as the Deputy Chair of the Banking Association Direct Tax Committee. I'm here with Jeanette, who will be taking you through the presentation today. And as the Banking Association, we have made a formal submission to National Treasury on our comments on the proposed amendments. And so amongst these comments, we included the limitation on the interest deduction, the restrictions on the set-off of assessed losses. But in this forum, we would like to focus on the most important proposed amendment that will have a substantial impact on the banking industry. And that is the proposed amendment around the collateral arrangement. As Jeanette is here, and we have prepared a presentation for you. As Jeanette is from First Rand, and she will take you through that presentation, and we're happy to take any questions, time permitting. Thank you, Jeanette. The platform is yours.
You have got 10 minutes, so you should be done by 5 minutes. 5 minutes past 11. Over to you, Jeanette and Itirele.
Thank you very much. I can get permission to share my presentation.
I've given you permission.
So just a moment. I'm hoping you can see my presentation.
No, we can't. I'll slide it from my side. If you can just indicate what slide we're on and move to the next slide.
Okay, fabulous. That's perfect. That's the first slide. Thank you so much, Chair, for the opportunity to present. On the multilateral arrangements and limitations that have been proposed, I thought it may be just opportune to just set a little bit of background and just as a history of where we've come from. And the collateral arrangements dispensation was introduced in 2015, and what it enables is the tax neutral outright transfer of collateral in the form of shares or government bonds. So that's while there is a transfer of beneficial ownership and of the collateral, there's no income tax, CGT or STT triggered by that. And this leaves the outright transfer of collateral then in the same tax neutral space that pledged collateral is, but the only change is that you've actually got beneficial ownership sitting with the collateral taker. Now, there were various reasons for the introduction of this dispensation in 2015, and these reasons were confirmed in the 2015 explanatory memorandum. And to start with, market liquidity was a major factor. So in the absence of a limitation on the reuse of outright collateral, collateral can be reused multiple times in multiple ways. And this ability to reuse collateral ensures that the collateral securities can re-enter the market and then not remain trapped in the hands of the collateral taker. Another main driver for the dispensation was the Reserve Bank's regulatory requirements for banks to hold high-quality liquid assets. Now, high-quality liquid assets are assets that banks beneficially own that are highly liquid and that can be realized for cash on short notice in the event of a liquidity squeeze or even a run on the bank. And then another regulatory requirement that was recognized and that was solved by the collateral arrangement dispensation was the ability for pension funds to use outside collateral to meet their Regulation 28 requirements. So if we move on to the proposed limitation, the draft TLAB proposes that for outright collateral, so that's collateral where beneficial ownership has changed, limitations on reuse be placed so that the only options for a collateral taker are to either hold the collateral to term or to reuse it for further collateral. The wording is extremely restrictive and it effectively prohibits any other use of collateral other than for further collateral purposes. The proposal goes further, so it not only restricts whether you can reuse your collateral, but it also requires the parties to include this undertaking not to reuse collateral in their legal agreements. So even if collateral is in fact not ever reused, and in 99% of situations, collateral will in fact not be reused. If the parties have not included this in their agreements, it falls outside the collateral arrangement dispensation and none of the tax benefits apply. And then lastly, the draft legislation was introduced retrospectively with effect from 28 July, which is the date that the draft TLAB was released. I'll touch a little later on the practical problems that this has created and the disruption that we're already seeing in the markets because of this retrospective implication. If we can move on to the next slide. So the our concerns with this proposal, apologies, starts with the fact that in terms of the current legislation, there actually is no need for a limitation on collateral. This is because in terms of the current legislation, the moment you use your collateral for anything outside of the collateral arrangement, you're immediately into full tax consequences. So in our minds, there is absolutely no reason to move away from an unlimited reuse of collateral. If National Treasury is aware of any specific abuse that is being perpetrated in the space of collateral arrangements, this really should be addressed through targeted anti-avoidance and not by way of a sledgehammer approach that really disrupts the markets and the financial sector in general. There are numerous non-collateral reuses of collateral that are absolutely justifiable and in fact essential. And we can maybe just start with the basics of the reuse of collateral by realizing it if there is a default. So the whole point of taking collateral is to enable the collateral taker of to realize it if there is a default. If you actually have a prohibition in your agreement that say that as collateral taker you cannot dispose of the securities on default, it really makes a mockery of collateral and it obviously cannot be used in the collateral space. For banks, one of the main drivers originally for the dispensation and an important utilization for banks of their outright collateral is for purposes of their HQLA assets. HQLA assets actually sit as beneficially owned by banks and are only reused in the event of a liquidity squeeze. So we're talking about a situation where these assets are unlikely to be reused, but we still need the opportunity to be able to use them if there is an HQLA requirement to do so. If we were forced to write limitations and restrictions into our legals, none of these assets could be used for banks' HQLA purposes. That is a very serious problem for the banking industry. We've already touched on the fact that pension funds require the use of their collateral assets for their Regulation 28 purposes. But then we can move straight back to banks, because a further requirement for banks is the daily repos that they enter into with the Reserve Bank. So for their funding requirements, banks use their outright collateral for repos with the Reserve Bank. If there is a restriction on reuse, this collateral will not be able to be used for Reserve Bank repos. And then with effect from January 2022, there is a large exposure requirement, which is a further regulatory requirement that is going to become effective for banks, and that is going to require banks to use and to enter into interbank repos with other commercial banks for funding requirements. And it's for those interbank repos that they will also need to be able to utilize their outright collateral, which will be limited and made impossible if this legislation does come in. So bottom all these essential and justifiable non-collateral reuses, there's also just basic optimization of collateral. So if I've taken collateral in as a collateral taker, I have beneficial ownership of that collateral, and instead of just having this collateral sit as lazy assets being unutilized, the beneficial owner would want to make use of this collateral for its best benefit, and that could be by way of trading this collateral, using the collateral in scrip loans, even selling the collateral for risk management, for instance, in option contracts. And all these reuses of collateral then tie into our comments on liquidity and market stability. So when the arrangement was introduced, liquidity and market stability and our place in making South Africa an optimal place to do business in was actually set up in the expansion memorandum as the main driver for the collateral arrangement dispensation. By limiting the reuse, we really limit liquidity, and we really do start affecting market stability in a big way. Then retrospectivity is also a large concern. We feel really strongly that retrospectivity should only be used in situations where you have extreme abuse and a tight timeline within which you need to shut down that abuse. The explanatory memorandum doesn't mention what abuse, if any, is being targeted here. It merely refers to policy considerations and the potential avoidance of STT and CPT without going into any details. We feel really strongly that it's inappropriate to have retrospective legislation that is so far-reaching off the back of no imminent danger to the fisc in place. If National Treasury is aware of specific abuse, we really feel that we should have targeted anti-avoidance legislation to target the specific abuse that they're concerned about, instead of hitting all collateral arrangements with a sledgehammer approach that really does serious damage to the financial sector, to banks in particular, and to the markets in general. We do feel that it was an overreach by National Treasury to employ retrospectivity, particularly where their legislation requires the amendment of agreements with no lead time whatsoever. So making this legislation effective from the 28th of July, when it was published in the evening of the 28th, and all collateral arrangements after that being subject to the agreements being changed, it was just, there's absolutely no practical way that parties could do that. And we've already seen an impact on the market in this regard, because what parties have had to do in the absence of amending their legals, which they just didn't have time to do, is just reverse from outright collateral to either pledge or cash. That's really impacted market liquidity. If we can move on to the next slide. Our proposed solution really is a deletion of the amendment in its entirety. We do not believe that the current legislation is not addressing the tax that becomes relevant the moment you step outside of a collateral arrangement. We do not believe that a limitation on the reuse is required. And we really are concerned with the dramatic impact on the financial services and market stability in general that this amendment is creating. And it's already creating uncertainty in the market. If there is specific abuse that's being targeted, we then propose that we do not have a sledgehammer approach restricting all collateral reuse. We would want to then see the introduction of targeted anti-avoidance. And we really urge National Treasury to consult with industry so that we can ensure that we can assist in getting to a workable solution that is practical to be implemented. And such a solution, if there is any limitation, really would need
to take some time. Hello, Jeanette.
Yes. Thank
How far are you from conclusion?
I thought that, at least I remember somewhere, that there would be some relief for small business. And the reason why small business, the first question is small business often has a lower rate, especially small business companies. Now, are they going to get a reduced rate? If they're not, then it's not a worthwhile trade-off for them. So that's the first question we have. The second thing that you have to keep in mind in small business is that most small businesses operate on cash. And generally, our system focuses on accrual, which generates income in the wrong years. So you might generate income, but you'll never collect. So they might be more sensitive to this loss limitation rule. Let's move on to the next slide. Okay, we've heard a bit about farming, and I think farming is that you've got to look at special sectors. So most sectors, profits steadily increase, or generally you have a profit line that goes from year to year, and generally businesses are expecting to make a profit year by year, except for the occasional bad year. And under that approach, where most businesses are profitable but for certain hardship years, the loss limitation rule isn't that impactful. But the real issue comes down to farming, as you've heard. We've already had two presentations, where you've got seasonal profit and loss. They don't look at things year by year. One year's profit, the next year is loss. And so where you've got this intermittent profit and loss, the proposal has a very undue impact. And I'm not sure, but I know the United States provides some relief for farming. And I think also to keep in mind in farming is that the Europeans and the U.S. and other countries subsidize their farmers, and they provide very generous tax rules for them. In South Africa, we don't subsidize, and our tax rules are already under the first schedule and not that exciting. And now you're actually going to deny them economic losses. So therefore, I think farming is a very important one that needs an escape hatch. Mining is another one. And they have, like, and also this happens with certain forms of farming. This farming is different, like wine farming, where you have years and years of loss and you've got to build up reserves. So those first years of profit are important in order to start offsetting the losses. And mining already has got ring fencing of its own. So I think these two sectors, especially the farming sector, needs to be carved out. Next slide. The 30% EBITDA limitation. Now, in addition to limiting losses, there'll be a limit on interest deductions. And one of the problems here with the interest deduction limitations is that when we originally did this years ago, we kept it at a 40% because banks sometimes do go to 40%. And 30% doesn't take into account facts and circumstances of various credibilities of business. So when banks make a loan, they will make a loan if it's more secure at a higher rate. But overall, the 30% may work, but there are two things. One, real estate. Real estate ratios are much higher than 30%, and so that is an exception. Second, banking. You've got to keep these two out. Banking is an intermediary. They borrow to on-lend. So these two sectors, especially foreign-owned banks, won't affect the BASA. BASA represents, I think, the big banks, more of the locals. But I think the foreign banks may be affected by this. So the foreign-owned banking and real estate needs to be exempted. The other one is the connected person test. I know 23M has got holes in it. I think they've closed it. But we have the issue of BEE. Other countries will say a more than 50% test is fine, but we often have independent BE parties up to 30%. And when you're making loans to the 70% shareholders, they're not completely influenced by tax. There isn't complete freedom. So 23M should take that into account and should only apply where there is a where there's a 71% or it's like a 76% or more. And so if they want to tighten 23M properly, they've got to make sure that they're not picking up commercial transactions. Okay, my time is very quick, so I'm trying to move this along. Okay, next slide. One of the big debates, and I'll be very quick about this, is how thin cap and 23M work. Both of them limit interest, and really both doing the same thing. So the real question is, why do we have both? Second, if we're going to have both, well, then it's transfer pricing should only come after 23M, which is a 30% rule. It becomes very onerous to put it before. And so therefore, I think there's a lot of calls to say that if you're going to have a rule that's limiting interest across the board, don't put transfer pricing on top of it, or only it should be applying in limited cases. And really, it seems that a lot of people feel that transfer pricing is kept just to get penalty rates out of taxpayers. So that's the next one. You see to move on. Last one is loans. They're trying to curb 7C. Now, we know that there's a lot of, that when trusts borrow money, that they should be paying an interest charge. If they don't, there's something non-commercial. And that's typically with the founder. The founder in history has made a loan to a trust with 0% interest. That's wrong. And the reason why that's done is to get around estate duty. And there's been a lot of crackdown on it. And now it appears there are new forms of abuses where they're getting a loan to a trust while another loan to a trust. But the problem is there's an overreach in this proposal. It's not just getting the money from dad and mom who are lending to the trust, but it's now affecting family trusts where dad and mom are long since gone, and now what's happening is the money is in trust, and you want to, instead of giving the money out to the kids right away, they'd rather lend it to the children. And that often happens where it's better to loan to the kids and keep it in the family trust. Not so much for tax reasons, but more for reasons of keeping the family amount money together. And the 7C proposal right now is picking out situations where dad and mom are long since gone. So loans from trusts, in the second example, should be okay. It's loans to trusts that are a problem. And I will curb it on that, and Biagi will take over.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you to the members. Just there's about 4 or 5 slides left. The first point is on the extension of sunset clauses for research and development and the energy efficiency. So in this particular case, there's a couple of reviews that's underway at present, and the premise is basically that up until the point where these reviews are complete, and since we do not yet know what the effect is of COVID-19 on specifically on these incentives, we request for a conservative approach, basically, for the sunset to be extended so that in the interim the status quo can remain, as a lot of the previous presenters have requested, for business continuity, for policy certainty. So in that respect, that is our request, so that specifically with the 11D and 12L, just for the postponement of the sunset clause, so that at least in the short term that the review can be finished and we can actually operate on certain facts. Second point on curbing the abuse in the ETI, we've set out here basically the current scheme, and we raised this, I know, as part of kind of Sight and Saika. We both, as the RCBs, raised this in 1999 because we started seeing members coming forth with these type of schemes. And absolutely fine with this scheme on the left-hand side of your screen, where there is a significant abuse in ETI in that there is actually no employment relationship. It is basically an abuse from beginning to end where there is no real job. It is a person receiving training, in some cases not proper training even, and no stipend is being paid. There is no payment for the person providing any work. And the only thing that happens is the employer, in this particular case, the so-called employer and the training institution together prey on the less fortunate person who is trying to find a job and trying to get some training to enter the job market properly, and claiming the ETR from the fiscus. So this is being shut down, and we're 100% for that. We've been asking for that. What our concern is that legitimate learnerships and apprenticeships could potentially be impacted. The word at present is used that it's mainly used for studying. Now, the word studying, legitimate learnerships and apprenticeships, to what extent can there be a distinction between that? If it's possible to write it into the legislation that these type of arrangements can continue, then absolutely fine with it. We just do not see it at present. So we are concerned that your standard rank and file legitimate learnerships will be affected, whether it is in a one employee to one employer relationship, or for example where, I don't think you can see here, but below here is, for example, a canteen where people are providing services in a contractual relationship to a canteen, but they are fully employed by the employer and the employer pays their salaries on a monthly basis. So these type of arrangements should not be affected. And we don't think that currently the legislation unfortunately carves this out. Then just a short note on ETI COVID-19. We welcome the related incentive enhancement. The only point here is there's a high degree of complexity here between what was initially envisaged in terms of the ETI Act, then brought forth in terms of last year's COVID changes and the assistance that was provided, and now the new changes. The query on our side and just the risk that we're pointing out is from what we could see in terms of the effective date and the payrolls being ready to basically roll this out, we are concerned that there is a high risk for overall under deduction, because in a lot of instances the people who would like to benefit from this would have to do the calculations manually. And from experience, even if you do this with a system, even if it's programmed, you're going to run into trouble. So just a caution on that. I don't know if at this point it's a done deal, but just from a SARS point of view, perhaps just be a bit lenient on this side. Then the interest charge on retirement fund savings when ceasing tax residence. I know that it's already been discussed. I know that my colleague hereafter will also discuss it. We understand that it's basically a mechanism to ensure that South Africa gets its fair portion of tax. That is understood. However, our big point on this is there's a high degree of complexity currently in our retirement fund system. And I think for those of us who've been following all the changes to retirement funds, from preservation funds, from the annuitization, etc., over the last, say, 10 odd years, to try to explain to any ordinary working South African how our retirement funds work and what they're investing in to get a tax deduction is almost impossible for them to understand fully. So as a value proposition, this newest change is adding to significant complexity, and it's only affecting those people who are currently in the system, and to a large degree, mostly retirement annuity fund holders. So from that perspective, the value of the retirement tax incentive as a regime is being diminished. And from that perspective, we just would like to put that as a consideration, that from our perspective where we sit, we are seeing people selecting different options. And from that perspective, for a South African as a whole, that is not it's not a good thing at all. Then two last slides. First off, COVID-19 and the industrial policy projects tax incentives. On this particular item, COVID has lasted longer than a year. There's long administrative delays at present. At the moment, the support provided, and thank you very much for that, it's to mitigate the non-compliance due to COVID by allowing a submission of motivation to the adjudication for an extension of the period. We are just proposing that here on the right-hand side, you will see that there's a variety of situations. Projects that have reached 4 years already, where they've already applied for an extension, so you have the information. You can risk assess. People that have already had an additional one-year extension, so the risk is there already mitigated. So in some instances, what we're asking is for a deeming of an additional period, just so that between the administrative delays and considering that COVID has now taken longer to deal with, that we just can get these the non-compliance out of the way for in at least in the short term. Then, on the clarity on various areas of overlap on carbon tax, because this is a new tax, sort of new, I think I know memory, and other colleagues have been living with this for years, but because of the industry that we're in and everything changes in this particular area almost on a day-to-day basis, we recognize that between overlap on a double taxation side, but also overlap on the side of the fiscus where there's a concern that not sufficient tax is being paid, the request is that more consideration be given both from a Treasury side and a SAR side on practical guidance on application, because it is a new and involving tax in an industry, and then also to consider all the various different types of scenarios. And with the submissions that we sent through to the committees, as well as to National Treasury, we've given a lot of examples of the areas where we would just like to see those particular situations also and scenarios also addressed in the legislation. Then lastly, something which you don't have in front of you, but which is on its way shortly, is that in our legislative cycle, we deal with the legislation on an annual basis, and we're all used to it, and it's a formalized process, and it works very well. The one thing that we don't have is the same type of almost process, formal process, for more of an administrative and tax administration and so forth. And by that, I do not mean specifically legislation, although that is almost sometimes handled as an afterthought, and you would see we don't speak much of it today. The item that needs to be addressed is that we need to have a little bit more of a robust and formal involvement by Parliament and the tax ombud and the committees, specifically on areas where perennially we have issues, and that is a submission I think that within the next couple of weeks we would like to send through to the committees as well, and then of course to National Treasury and SARS. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, South African Institute of Taxation, right? Next is South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, SAICA, 10 minutes.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members. Good morning to you all. I'm going to be touching on a lot of the, so I'll go quickly through those, but continue with the ones that I want to deal with what she hasn't dealt with. Three main topics. First one, policy changes. There's two items under that, your technical amendments and the matters that are not addressed in the bill. And that's kind of alludes to what Beatrice was saying. There's certain things that we have been putting through in an extra C that don't seem to be coming through in the bill, and we're just wondering, you know, we need to start addressing those at some stage too. So if we look at the policy changes, we have two, as I mentioned. The first one is the exit tax on your retirement when you leave or cease residence in South Africa. And the second one is the assessed losses that a lot of the commentators have already spoken about today. Let's start with the first one, the tax on the retirement fund, in terms of the new Section 9HC. So we have various concerns in this regard, and the first one is the constitutionality of these particular provisions. So the requirement here is that as you cease to be a resident, you will be deemed to have disposed of your interest in the retirement fund, and you have to pay tax on that particular interest. Now, that tax is not payable now. It's actually only payable at the end when you exit the fund and you take the money out. Now, that's limited as well. It's restricted at this stage for the minimum of 3 years. You cannot access those funds for 3 years after you can then prove that you cease to be a South African tax resident. It's similar to say, and then the other thing is that you're now going to be paying interest on the tax that you deem to have paid when you exit or when you cease being a South African resident, and that interest will also then be paid on exit. So this is pretty similar to them saying we're going to pay your salary, we're going to withhold the pay as you earn, but we're not going to give you your salary for the next 3 years. So we do have a bit of a concern that this is a constitutional issue, that SARS is kind of forcing you to borrow this money from them and forcing you to pay interest on this money that you're borrowing from them without having access to the funds at that particular stage. The second concern also has a constitutional element to it, is the circumventing of the DTAs. Now, again, the DTAs that South Africa has signed with all the various countries, these have been negotiated by the government, they've been signed by the South African government, and they've been ratified by Parliament. What we are potentially suggesting here is that we're going to be overriding some of the DTAs, because a lot of the DTAs give the taxing rights to the country of residence. Once a person ceases to be in South Africa, they become a resident of the other country. When they withdraw from the fund, generally they will have the taxing rights. And in the budget speech, it was quite clearly highlighted that the reason for the introduction of this section is because South Africa is losing out tax on the retirement funds when people leave the country. Now, it's really unfair to tax the taxpayer after all these DTAs have been negotiated. It's not the taxpayer's fault that there might be a tax loophole here, to say, and to put this burden now on the taxpayers is quite concerning. It's not just an administrative burden, but it could in certain circumstances result in double taxation, and that's our concern, because that is in clear violation of all our international tax agreements. If we look at the other technical amendments, I'm not going to go into those in detail. It is in our submission. You can have a look at it, but there are quite a few there as well. And also it doesn't cater for individuals that cease to be a resident and then become South African residents. Again, it doesn't cater for that. I think as Beatrice sort of alluded to as well, is that the impact that this particular provision has had on the industry and on individuals, those individuals that do have the money. We've seen individuals that are willing to pay the tax at this stage just to get their money out. It's creating a lot of uncertainty, and money that should be staying in our country seems to be wanting to move now because of these proposed amendments. So I think it's had a real adverse effect on this, and hopefully we can address it. So our recommendation in this regard is it needs to be withdrawn. We need to go back to the drawing board. We need to consult with the industry on this. You cannot force people to pay tax and you can't take your money out. You must at least give them access to their money at that stage, so they don't have to pay interest on the money, or not forced to pay interest on money that they can't take out. Or we need to renegotiate the DTAs. But either way, this proposal cannot carry on as is. If we look at the assessed losses, again, being raised by a lot of commentators, so I'll run through these quite quickly. The concerns that we have is that there is no threshold for SMEs. We heard how it affects certain sectors, but particularly amongst the SMEs in all sectors would be potentially affected by these changes. We're also saying, as many commentators have said, that the timing is ill-advised. A lot of the businesses are affected by COVID and now also the recent unrest, making their cash flows quite unpredictable, and that they need this time to actually get the cash flows back up and running and not have to pay tax up front now on the 20%. There's also certain technical problems related to the corporate rule and REITs, which I'm not going to go into. It is in our submission, as well as the impact on certain investment allowances that could result in companies creating assessed losses. So there might be adverse investment decisions being made based on the back of this particular change. So we also either delete this, or we need to consider delaying it for at least 2 years until the companies are back up and running on their feet. They've got sufficient cash reserves to cater for this additional tax that they would have to pay. Again, linking it to the reduced tax rate is ideal. I mean, we're not against the reduction in tax rate by any means. To broaden the tax base and reduce the tax rate is ideal, but I think at this stage, the less of the two evils is to forgo the assessed losses rather than having the reduction in the tax rate. If I move on to the technical challenges, at the moment we've got three of those. We're looking at contributed tax capital, Section 7C, and the ETI amendments that have also been touched on by various commentators. Now, with the contributed tax capital, the current wording as it stands, unfortunately, is going to prevent a lot of share buybacks from happening. And as Basa mentioned, also this amendment is retrospective, which creates a huge problem, especially if the abuse is not targeted, or what you're trying to do is not being addressed with the current wording in the legislation. So again, we do recommend that this particular amendment be withdrawn, and rather tackle this abuse with your general anti-avoidance provisions or your specific provisions in line with the abuse that National Treasury and SARS are seeing. Or we need to reword this quite clearly to make sure that we only reduce the contribution tax capital if all shareholders who participate in the distribution receive proportionate amounts of contributed tax capital in relation to the original contributions. So making sure that individuals don't take out more than what they've actually originally contributed to the company. Touching on 7C, which has also been mentioned before, again, it is a very wide amendment affecting bona fide inter-trust loans. And again, we suggest this be withdrawn and tackle this abuse, the abuse that they are suggesting is happening, with specific anti-avoidance provisions. On to the ETI, a very interesting presentation before on this particular thing. And we've also, as Beatrice also mentioned, raised the concern with the abuse that is taking place in this particular thing. So we do welcome the proposed change and the reiteration that it's always been a National Treasury policy that the employee has to work for the employer. But as Beatrice pointed out, we do have certain concerns on the secondment of employees with learnerships and apprenticeships. That's not really clarified as such currently. And also the interaction between the different acts, your Basic Condition of Employment Act and your Labour Relations Act. You'll see that it's quite critical because in some cases this interaction could prevent an employer from actually, or an employee qualifying for this relief in terms of the ETI Act. Very importantly, and the most important point that we want to put across in this regard is that it hasn't been made clear enough that this wage that is paid to the employee has to be a cash wage. And this stems from the definition of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, is that cash actually has to be paid to these particular employees. It cannot be a round-tripping where that is, you know, an interspecies kind of payment to a third party. It has to be actually cash to the employee. So we've made various recommendations there, but the critical one being that cash has to be paid, and I think that will put a quick stop to a lot of the abuse that is currently taking place in this space. And then, as I said, we move on to matters on the bill. We regularly, on a yearly basis, raise concerns in the Annexure C submissions. As Beatrice also alluded to, a lot of these concerns we don't see filtering through in the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, but a lot of them are really, really critical, and we will be making joint submissions as well, as Beatrice mentioned, on some of those really important issues. But the three that we want to highlight today are the associate enterprise definition, the Section 18A certificates, and the disability expenses. Now, if we start off with the associated enterprise definition that was inserted into Section 31, the effective date of that has now been deferred to the 1st of January 2022. And National Treasury, in a presentation to this committee, the Senate Committee of Finance in 2019, said that they would provide, SARS would provide guidance on this particular meaning of the definition, because it is quite wide. So it's 2019 that they did the presentation. SARS has not released that guidance yet. We've only got 4 months till the implementation of this particular section or definition. So we are urging SARS to please provide the guidance, because it does make does have a huge impact on transfer pricing transactions. It broadens the scope quite a lot. So we definitely need guidance, further guidance on this definition of associated enterprise. Otherwise, we would suggest that the legislation needs to be amended, that the effective date for this change be postponed to the 1st of January 2023. On the Section 18A certificates, our concern here, or what SARS is trying to avoid, is the abuse. Certain certificates are being issued for which a tax deduction is allowed, and they're trying to prevent this abuse. And they also want to introduce third-party reporting for these Section 18A certificates. Now, the concern that we have is a lot of these PBOs would not be able to comply with the third-party reporting once it's introduced. It would be very difficult and costly for them to apply, and they already are struggling with a large administrative and compliance cost burden. So it is concerning, but our biggest concern is in terms of Section 18.2 Cap B. Now, this section requires that a PBO has to get an audit certificate confirming that all the Section 18A certificates that were issued for deductible donations were used for the purposes, which is a Part 2 qualifying expenses in the ninth schedule. Now, the concern here, and we did raise this back in 2018 already with SARS and National Treasury, is that auditors are at this stage refusing to issue the certificate because they're saying it is not in line with the auditing framework, the international auditing framework. And it is putting the PBOs in a real predicament, because they can lose their exempt status if they cannot provide provide SARS with this particular audit certificate. So as mentioned before, we propose that this change be, you know, not enacted, and that they rather focus on the fraud in this regard. But we urge SARS and National Treasury to please get together with IRBA to discuss what are the ways in which we can ensure that these certificates are issued, but that they are issued by credible auditors, and auditors can actually act, because at the moment the auditors cannot comply with the law, and this puts the PBO's tax exemption status into question. So yeah, that engagement hopefully will happen soon. If we look at the disability expenses, so the concern here is that there were proposed amendments released this year. They were subsequently withdrawn, but our bigger concern is that SARS seems to be targeting the most vulnerable in society with these proposed changes, especially in light of the fact that government is not providing much support to a lot of these disabled persons. Now, the March 2020 changes that were introduced in respect of these disability expenses, they seem to be causing more harm than good, and you know, what SARS is trying to do is split education from the disability expenses. Now, in theory, that is correct, but in practice, it is misplaced. A lot of these, you know, individuals are not going there for education. None of them, most of them will not get a matric. So it's not just education with a little bit of assistance. It's a lot more assistance rather than education. But that's another debate. But we have another concern that in this section actually allows the commissioner to decide what is taxable and what is not. And that has a constitutional element to it. It should only be Parliament that decides what is taxable and not. So this is something, again, that we have raised before and hasn't been addressed. So we are working with a lot of industry, and we will be engaging further with SARS on this particular matter to try and come up with a solution that is amenable to both parties, both SARS and the disabled parents. And we are collaborating with civil society to find a proper solution. And we do hope that SARS's powers will be brought within the law as well. And that's it from our side. Thank you.
Hi, good morning, or afternoon, well, morning, so I think the chairperson has lost connection. PwC is up next. I don't know if you want to ask him to...
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Okay. I've requested Honorable Abrams to take over. I think the next presenter is PwC.
That's correct, Chair.
Yeah, can PwC present?
Thank you, Chair. I'll do so now.
Yeah, check Ms. Abraham, if she's not yet connected, I'll request her to take over the chair.
I'm here, sir.
Open.
Okay, just to confirm that you can see my screen.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members. My name is Kyle Mandy. I'm the tax policy leader for PwC South Africa. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you this morning. We have made a detailed submission, which has been made available to the members. I don't intend to go through every single item that's in that submission by any stretch of the imagination. What I would like to do is focus on three main issues, and then we won't even get into all the technical issues or technical difficulties with those. I just want to highlight certain key points that I think the members need to be aware of. Some of the issues have already been addressed by other commentators, so I don't intend to go through everything in absolute detail but do wish to highlight certain points that I do think the members need to be aware of. In relation to the first item that we want to bring to your attention is on the retirement funds with the so-called, if you like, proposed exit tax. As the other commentators have pointed out, this is essentially boiled down to a situation where South Africa has given relief insofar as contributions and the taxation associated with retirement funds is concerned, and ultimately ends up losing the tax rights when the individuals concerned immigrate, migrate their residence to certain treaty countries. I emphasize that it's certain treaty countries, not all treaty countries where South Africa loses its taxing rights. So we certainly have sympathy for the situation that that government finds itself in, insofar as that scenario is concerned. But that does not mean that there are no concerns associated with the proposal. The concerns involve a number of key issues. The first one is that, in essence, as other commentators have pointed out, South Africa is essentially trying to override the terms of negotiated treaties between between South Africa and various other countries in question. Those two terms would have been negotiated in good faith, with full awareness of the tax implications and the tax systems of the two countries concerned. And that in itself is problematic from a policy perspective. Add to that, that in our view, it's doubtful that the proposed amendments will actually achieve their desired objectives. And we say that because, well, the Netherlands and Belgium actually attempted similar exit taxes a number of years back, and for similar reasons. And the courts in those countries ultimately held that they were attempted treaty overrides and that they were then in contravention of the treaty. So ultimately they were not successful insofar as their legislation and their attempted exit taxes were concerned. It is therefore likely that, number one, we are going to see similar challenges taking place in South Africa, insofar as that's concerned, and with a high likelihood that the South African courts will follow the same approach as was adopted by the courts in the Netherlands and in Belgium. So what we could end up with is a protracted number of years with disputes and uncertainty prevailing, with ultimately the objectives not being achieved. The other commentators have also raised the concerns around double taxation, and we certainly share those concerns, but what we would add is that that is anathema to attracting skills and attracting investment. And anecdotal evidence, as we sit, suggests that there have already been reactions to the proposed legislation, with individuals accelerating migration of residents and immigration, and also accelerating withdrawals from South African retirement funds as a result. So we do need to be aware of the implications of the proposed legislation as well. There are a number of significant practical administrative challenges. I'm not going to get into all of that. The detail that we've set is set out in our detailed submission. Add to that, that Treasury has actually adopted a one-size-fits-all approach. So the proposed legislation does not only apply in situations where South Africa loses the right to tax, but applies in all situations where the individual concerned has migrated their tax residence to another country, regardless of whether they are a treaty country or not, and regardless of whether South Africa retains the taxing right or not. And that adds to substantial and significant complexity due to the legislation as well. Some of the other commentators have spoken around value of the retirement benefit. So there are very significant uncertainties around the determination of value when it comes to those retirement benefits at the point of cessation of residence, not only in relation to defined contribution funds, but also in relation to defined benefit funds. And I've already mentioned the administrative complexity. So ultimately, what is our recommendation in this regard? Well, as I said up front, we certainly sympathise with the situation of government. It is not ideal that that South Africa provides relief in relation to retirement funds and ultimately is not able to tax those funds on withdrawal. But that does not mean the solution lies in the legislation itself. Ultimately, the solution, albeit a difficult solution, lies in renegotiating the relevant tax treaties, of which there are a number. So our suggestion is that the proposal should be withdrawn in its entirety, and that rather South Africa should use its time and start embarking on renegotiating the treaties that are of concern. The second element that I want to, or the second key proposal I want to touch on is around the interest limitation rules. Some of the other commentators have already spoken about it, so I do not intend to touch on everything. Safe to say that there are numerous technical issues that Treasury still needs to address. Some of them were touched on in the discussion document that Treasury issued last year. Many of those issues were discussed, but very few of them have actually been addressed ultimately in the legislation. So those still need to be attended to as well. There is effectively a new subject to tax rule, which essentially says that where the interest in question is not subject to tax in the hands of the recipient at a rate of at least 28%, then a pro rata portion of that interest will be treated as not being subject to tax for purposes of the rule, and hence the interest deduction limitation will apply to the interest in question. That rule, in many respects, is draconian and inequitable. As an example, and this is not the only example, it ignores the fact that that our withholding tax and interest, at least from a domestic tax rate perspective, is levied at a rate of 15% on a gross amount of interest, whereas our 28% rule, which is the standard rate for corporate income tax, is actually taxed on a net income or net profit basis. You know? So the distinction between taxing our income on a gross basis versus taxing income on a net basis is completely ignored and is inequitable. There are also significant concerns around the approach insofar as immovable property is concerned. As a general proposition, where immovable property has an elevated debt capacity, if you like, that is recognised in other provisions within the tax legislation but has been ignored for the purposes of this provision. And then related in some respects is the question of REITs, where we certainly believe that the application of any limitation in the context of REITs is entirely inappropriate for a few reasons. One, that REITs already have by way of legislation and regulation, I have a limited debt capacity limited to 60% of assets, and then ignoring the fact that REITs are essentially are tax transparent flow through vehicles by reason of the tax regime that's applied to them. So I believe it's completely inappropriate to be applying interest deduction limitations in the context of REITs. There are particular challenges when it comes to mining as well, particularly insofar as the application of the rules in the context of capital expenditure allowances and the ring fences associated with those are concerned. That is something that Treasury has not considered and is certainly not addressed in the legislation. Then when it comes to public benefit projects...
Please say to round up.
I will try to get through this as quickly as possible. You bear with me. So public benefit projects, certainly OECD in the BEPS report recommended that the public benefit projects should be excluded from the application of the rules. So what we're talking about is things such as infrastructure projects in the form of energy projects, read renewable energy projects in the cyber context, but it could also include such things as water and other infrastructure, including roads, ports, et cetera, given the public interest nature of those projects. Suggested that those should be excluded. Some of the other commentators have spoken about the minimus rules and so on when it comes to small business. I do not intend to repeat that. There was also a question of a safe harbor that was mentioned in the discussion paper, and that has been completely ignored insofar as capitalization is concerned. The last point I want to address is the limitation on carry forward of assessed losses. As some others have mentioned, there's policy incoherence when it comes to incentives and how those correlate with the limitation on the use of assessed losses. What I do want to point out, and I think this is important if you allow me the time, is that South Africa's regime will go from one of the most lenient regimes when it comes to tax losses to one of the most onerous regimes in the world. And that's for the simple reason that many other countries that have got similar limitations on the use of losses to that's been proposed here have one or both of two other mechanisms that, if you like, mitigate against those limitations on the use of assessed losses. They allow the carry back of assessed losses to earlier years of assessment. Or they have group tax regimes which allow the losses within one company in the group to be offset against the profits of another company in the group. And in terms of analysis that we've done, and it's highlighted here, we looked at 44 countries' tax loss regimes. Of those, 16 countries have a similar regime insofar as the limitation on the use of assessed losses is concerned, as is being proposed by Treasury in this instance. But of those, only three countries did not have a group tax regime which allowed the assessed losses to be set off in the group. And on those three countries, they certainly do not represent the benchmark and are not the countries that South Africa necessarily wants to be in conjunction with insofar as that's concerned. So we are certainly suggest that if this is to go ahead, then we should be looking to introduce a group tax relief as part of the equation, so far as this is concerned. Others have spoken around timing. Timing remains a concern from our perspective as well. In the interest of time, I will not get into that. Nor will I get into the detail around the application to small companies is concerned. We share those concerns, and we also share the concerns insofar as certain sectors of the economy are concerned, particularly insofar as mining, life insurance and REITs as well, where those have not been taken into consideration. Thank you, Chair. I'll end it there.
Please, thank you so much. You've been heard. The last presenter will be Tech Consult. If Tech Consult can please take the podium.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Jean de Toy and I represent Tax Consulting South Africa. Our submission specifically relates to the proposed taxation of retirement interests upon the cessation of residency. And we also make this submission on behalf of the Expatriate Petition Group, which is a group of around 15,000 individuals that represent South Africans living and working abroad, but also those considering international work offers and those who have left South Africa that still maintain ties with this country. And before I touch on the technical aspects that have partially already been addressed by my predecessors, I would like to contextualize the proposed amendment from the perspective of this group. The proposed amendment is a further legislative intervention that will have a direct impact on this group of taxpayers. We also represented the expat petition group when the foreign employment exemption was amended back in 2017. And at that time, stakeholders also cautioned against the wider negative impact that the amendment could have, where expatriates would be forced to make long-term decisions regarding their ties with South Africa.
And at that point, at least experienced in our practice, the amendment was followed by a surge in immigration applications. And the same happened when it was when it was announced that the immigration process through the Reserve Bank will be replaced with the rule where retirement interests will be locked in for a 3-year period before immigrating taxpayers can withdraw their retirement interests. And in fact, the background to phasing out the immigration process was that government wanted these individuals to maintain their ties with South Africa. But again, from our experience, it seemed that the amendment had the opposite effect, where there was a rush among internationally mobile taxpayers to complete the immigration process before the effective date of 1 March 2021. Now, again, the introduction of Section Cap H, Cap C will impact this group of taxpayers directly. And we conducted a survey across this group, and the results are that almost 76% of these individuals still have retirement interest in South Africa, whatever their current status is. And 88% of the participants indicate that this amendment will have a negative impact on them personally, and 65% noted that this amendment will fundamentally change their retirement. Now, these stats do not form the basis of our submission, but it still illustrates that the latest proposal would again force this group of taxpayers to take stock of their circumstances and to make long-term decisions regarding their South African tax residency. And it adds to the narrative that this group of individuals have to operate within a system where there seems to be little regard for their interests, and it gives credence to the belief that there's at least some uncertainty on what they can face in years to come. Currently, the proposed amendment is counterintuitive to government's objective to keep the members of this important segment of the tax base within the South African tax net, and beyond that, it discourages taxpayers across the board to keep their retirement interests in South Africa. So, in addition to that, I'll also raised some more technical concerns, but most of these have been addressed by my predecessors. First, we echo what SAICA and what PwC said, that this would constitute South Africa's first treaty override. It's even acknowledged, or it seems to be acknowledged in the explanatory memorandum, so it appears that National Treasury has reconciled itself with this fact, so it would be interesting to get their comment on that. Again, addressed by my predecessors, the fact that it overrides some of our treaties at least would lead to double taxation, because there would be no requirement on the future country of residence to give a tax credit, either in terms of the treaty or in terms of their domestic law. And it's any suggestion that a foreign country should provide a credit in these cases would be peculiar, given that our domestic credit under Section 6 Quat will not allow for this. And in fact, the now repealed Section 6 Quin was specifically removed from our domestic law because we no longer wanted to give tax credits where other countries flouted their treaty obligations. So we don't know how National Treasury proposes to deal with that. Again, to echo what SAICA and PwC said, the treaties that stand to be contravened occupy the same status as our domestic legislation. They are subsumed under the Income Tax Act. So the fact that this provision is inconsistent with at least some of our treaties means that it contravenes the Income Tax Act itself. And flowing from that, it likely means that we would violate our good faith obligations under these treaties and also the Vienna Convention. And to our knowledge, this will be a first for South Africa, so it begs the question why an exception would be made in this case. And beyond the international or these points raised, it serves to note that the proposed tax would be very, very distortive because of the inherent mismatch in timing between the tax event and the payment of tax. The reality is that the value of retirement interests is determined determined by the underlying investments such as equities, and it's entirely possible, especially in the current climate, that the value of these investments may decline after the tax was triggered. So the upshot is the taxpayer may end up paying tax on a higher amount than what they actually receive, not to mention the fact that interest will be levied in respect of the inflated tax at potentially higher tax rates if these tax tables end up changing in future. So in these cases, the tax may be exceedingly punitive. And I would also like to point out that the proposal essentially forces taxpayers to incur interest. This situation is created by legislative intervention that gives the taxpayer no choice, and it further erodes their retirement interest. But ultimately, what the section would serve as is an additional and a strong disincentive for South Africans and taxpayers across the board to keep their retirement interests in South Africa. And there are some other ancillary points, but these have mostly been touched on and in our submission and by my predecessors. But ultimately, if this amendment is enacted, it can only be accommodated if we amend, for example, the Tax Administration Act, the Pension Fund Act, and the Retirement Fund Rules, to name but a few. Yeah, that's it. Thank you. That's it from us.
Thank you so much, Tax Consult. Yes, you spoke within your time, which is very good. So, yeah. you saved. Honorable members, there it is, all the submissions that we had initially received, most of them written, have now been presented to us as the portfolio committee. Any takers? Anyone who wants to comment? Clarity questions and so on?
Chairperson, my hand is up.
Honorable George,
thank
you. Can come in.
Thank you very much. Chair, the submissions by SAICA and PwC and Tax Consult all speak to a similar issue, a broad issue surrounding the situation for people who choose to locate elsewhere in the world. I do think that obviously SARS is going to be commenting on the submissions by the various stakeholders, but I would urge SARS and the National Treasury to think very clearly about the inputs that have been received, because it certainly has created a large amount of confusion and possibly even fear amongst taxpayers, because it isn't clear what they are trying to do. Now, I'm sure that they've looked at other jurisdictions. For example, if you look at the United States of America, it requires all of its citizens, irrespective of where they are resident in the world, to file tax. And then, of course, there are tax agreements with other jurisdictions, which then reduce the tax burden, etc. So certainly what I'll be looking for is to make sure that a thorough process has taken place to make sure that we aren't hitting this sideways and causing a lot of unintended consequences. So I look forward to the feedback from SARS and National Treasury on that. And then particularly on the retirement funds, we do know that retirement fund reform in South Africa has been on the table for over 20 years, and it has been a very tortuous and sort of so far unsuccessful process. But certainly the proposal now regarding taxing retirement monies that are locked up before the member's able to access them makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. It actually just smacks of desperation, sadly, desperation by the tax authorities to get more money in the tax net, given we know that the number of taxpayers is dwindling. But that is very problematic, and we'll have to see whether it's constitutional even. But that is a huge concern that needs to be addressed, and I'm looking forward to SARS and National Treasury giving more feedback on that. But certainly I would resist that proposal too. Makes no sense that you have to actually pay tax on something you can't have. Perhaps we should be talking about a clean break rather than a long and torturous process. But those are my initial thoughts. Thank you very much to the presenters, and thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Dr. George. Thank you so much for the input. It enhances the presentations that have been made. And yes, you are right. In most cases, the different institutions really express their views of the public out there in their various corners of interest. Honorable members, there be no more questions or no more hands up. I will ask that Alan make the necessary announcement. Alan?
Thank you. Announcement is that tomorrow's meeting, 9 to 12, briefing by 3G and SARS on double taxation agreements. The committee had initially planned to adopt, I think, a Kuwait agreement, but unfortunately those documents weren't signed, so it's not ready for the committee to adopt. So Deborah will send through those documents and the link to the meeting sometime during the course of today. And also just to highlight that SARS, our National Treasury, will respond to all these submissions on the 13th of October. I will obviously, going forward in the next couple of weeks, I'll send the response document presentation and the link to all participants in today's meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. I think that's clear enough to all of us. And I just want to take the opportunity as well just to thank the presenters. And the issue of public participation is very critical. And the South African public has to find a way to make sure that their voices are heard. That's what our democracy is all about. And as Honorable George has already indicated, we're hoping that Treasury and SARS will take care of those areas that are possible to be taken care of. Unless they're really in a corner in some, we do not know. We will await their response. Thank you so much for coming forward with this. We know that you represent your institutions, but by and large, you represent the broader society. Thank you so much for coming through to the Portfolio Committee. We will await the responses from Treasury and SARS, and you will get an invitation to come and listen so that you can be able to probe your concerns even further. Thank you so much. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Members.
Recording stopped.